Their whole purpose throughout history has been to teach a small number of people how to become adept at controlling everyone else and presenting their societies as desirable to the profane, so that you'll go knock on the door and say, "Hey, can I be a member and be initiated?" With the promise of learning some great secret. What is that secret? The secret is what I have just told you this morning. The secret is how to control everybody else. And you never understand how to control everybody else until you get to the top of this pyramid of initiation. Most people never make it past the third step. All above that are carefully chosen and nurtured and taught. And Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy. They've never been able to find an enemy. So those who control them were able to control them even better by giving them an enemy. That's what Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt determined at Yalta. Who was going to be the enemy post-war? Turned out to be Stalin. And there was going to be this phony Cold War so that the population would never discover the real enemy. And I'm talking about the population of the Soviet Union as well as the rest of the world. You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces, who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the Mysteries.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 9th of August 2024, streaming live from Eastone Studios in Bristol, which, with London's Inner Temple, is one of several Templar ports in the Empire of Lies, alongside the Inner Temple in London and, of course, Edinburgh, Rosslyn Chapel, places like that. This is where the Templars used to hang out, our lovely old soldiers of Christ, supposedly, doing the first set of crusades, which we're now living through the second set of crusades. We are live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, radiosoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex, and we'll be hearing a bit from Paul English, who runs that a little bit later on today, and live also on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, probably the easiest way to listen to the show, so it's got all the longer interviews on there as of later in the evening. You can have a listen to them late tonight or else tomorrow. If you fancy, that's all available free from all good app stores. Aurora, please, not Google Play, by the way. Google told me this week that I had to put passwords in and facial recognition and biometrics. Google Play, just to have an app. Don't do that. Just get hold of Aurora, and then you can just disable Google Play. Those nasty little NSA transhumanists trying to get your bio data in exchange for giving you some crummy app which is probably going to censor things anyway. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military grade propaganda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes, McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against World War III and wage slavery. One thing's for sure, they're never going to give you the real debate, but we do here, we hope anyway, something to really challenge your brain cells and to get you thinking. They don't want you thinking. They want to tell you what to think. We don't. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, those so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, cost of living, climate, a new one every few months, the twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse. And the politicians have nothing to say. Nick Land's behaviourist dark enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks want us as slaves to their machines, and Albert Pike's World War III slugfest relies on your blind obedience, folks. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and witch queen Camilla wage war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS, through their latest glove puppet with look what crawled out of the recycling bin, panda-eyed energy saboteur Ed Miliband. So anyway, helping us navigate the accelerationist WEF's fourth industrial revolution. And the Fourth Reich Matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Part one this week, we'll be hearing from various people about the sort of far-right resurgence or whatever it is, and it seems to me that the people in charge of it are basically now working from abroad, and they were deliberately let to go abroad. And also, we'll have some comparisons with previous race riots and from people like Tony Greenstein and Stephen Dorrell this week, exclusive interviews with them. Also in part two, Scott Ritter, he's has his house searched by the FBI, but I thought rather than go into depth in what happened with the FBI, because that's their little agenda, let's have a listen to what he had to say the day before he was searched. Had some really interesting stuff on the Judging Freedom podcast with Judge Neapolitano, so we'll be hearing Scott Ritter talking about some of that. So anyway, Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel and by Ofcom, and us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, and from PRSC by the trans lobby, but not from here yet, thank God. So Martin, can you just give us an idea of what you make of these we had supposedly massive protests going to go on Wednesday evening throughout the country. Nothing much happened. On Saturday it was another story, wasn't it? Things did actually happen, and there was, for example, protests here in Bristol.
Yeah, well, I think obviously there was quite a lot of panic in the media and in society in general because of what had happened the previous week. Obviously, much more to be felt within Muslim communities who were directly in the firing line, and people who were asylum seekers in hospitals, hostels, and so on. And you know, what happened in Old Market in Bristol was everything was boarded up because there was a fear that there was going to be lots of disorder. That was on the Saturday night. They turned up, but they were outnumbered by the anti-racist demonstrators or whatever. There was a bit of a standoff, and eventually, you know, it went on for quite a while, but eventually they went home and some people were arrested. But on Saturday, I think what's happened is the police have been videoing all of these people. I mean, you'd think that they'd have the sense to realise this. They're not going to arrest you on the day. As soon as if they've got video footage of you, and don't get many of these people are actually putting video footage of themselves up. It's not the sort of thing that anybody would do in Northern Ireland, although we've had trouble over there as well. In the past, people knew how to deal with it. You know, if you're going to riot, you don't do it like that. And I'd say the same about
This is an interesting type of policing, isn't it? So they're not actually going to arrest you doing anything. They're going to let you carry on doing it. They're just going to come knock on the door at 3 o'clock in the morning the next day. So
no, they have arrested some people on the spot. But you can't arrest all the people on the spot. And the main thing, of course, is to protect the mosque or whatever. So you get the shields up, and if anybody comes close, you whack them over the head with a riot bat on. But then they all think they can go home, and that's going to be the end of it. And suddenly they've found, in actual fact, you're getting knocks on the door the next day, which is always going to happen. And by the Wednesday, I think the people who are instigating all of this realised that we're all hiding to nothing. So they didn't even bother to turn up.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, there's another way of looking at it, and that is that the whole thing on Wednesday was deliberate disinformation, complete lies, and there was never any intention of doing anything much on Wednesday at all.
Well, exactly. But, I mean, in a sense, what everybody was taken by surprise at the beginning of all of this. Because don't forget, nobody knew who carried out the stabbing in Southport, and it was only on social media, and if you weren't paying attention, you wouldn't have known it, that it was all circulated. It was a Muslim immigrant who just got off a boat. So most people didn't even know that that was the issue. So they then turned up by surprise, and they were able to start doing what they were doing, you know, with the police unaware of they obviously were aware, but they weren't aware of they might have been. And so they were able to get away with it because nobody really knew what was going on. But by the Wednesday, I got an email from my trade unions saying, you know, we are going to be going down there. And of course, that's, you know, and the head of Avon Somerset Police said afterwards that the people who came to protest against the far right behaved exemplary. He said those crowd behaved with exemplary. And of course, what they're doing is protecting the Avon Bristol Law Centre, which is supposedly what the target of the attack. And elsewhere in the country, people were standing outside mosques to prevent them doing anything to the mosques. And, of course, that's a non-violent tactic. The police can then stand in front of the people who are standing outside the mosque, and if you turn up, A, you're going to get whacked over the head with a riot baton, and B, if you do anything else, we're going to arrest you and send you to prison.
Yeah, but that sounds great in theory, but it's not what happened last Saturday, is it? There was some rucks in central Bristol, and yes. There was also the Mercure Hotel, where there are asylum seekers being kept overnight. Well, no, actually, they're permanently pretty much in there. There are other places, there are holiday inns and this sort of thing. But this particular hotel, there are quite a lot of asylum seekers in there, and the far right were allowed to get right up to the place. And the police were nowhere to be seen, but it was the Bristol massive but passive demonstrators forming lines around that hotel and between the far right and the door that actually stopped them getting in. So where were the police?
Well, I mean, the police eventually turned up, but if there'd been nobody standing in front of the hotel, then they would have got in there. I think it's interesting.
So why is it that Bristol citizens have got to go and do the police's job for them?
Well, I think what's actually happened is that the police and the community have cooperated together to deal with the situation. And I think that's actually worked quite well in Bristol.
So what you're saying is the police have said to the demonstrators, oh, it's okay, we're not going to bother with that one, you cover that base.
No, listen, I'm not.
Well, that's what you're implying.
Were you there? I wasn't there. I saw some of it on the internet. I didn't go down. Because I basically didn't want to get into a fight with them. On the other, but people
that's not
did.
That's not like you.
Well, no, because I'm getting old, Tony.
Look, I mean, you know, look, Martin, you've been in many of these sorts of demonstrations before. But it is a bit extraordinary that the intelligence of the locals here in Bristol seem to be better than that of the police.
Well, I suspect that the far-right demonstrators, they assembled in Castle Park. Now, in Castle Park, there isn't anything in Castle Park, yeah? Apart from some random Muslim mum passing with her pushchair. So they probably didn't even realise that hotel had asylum seekers in, and our lot did, so they went to protect it, and then the other lot came across to try and, you know, following them. I'm not sure exactly what happened. I wasn't there. And obviously, you need to talk to people who were there. Plenty of people were there, and they can tell you what they thought happened. I wasn't there.
No, I spoke to Brighton's finest, Tony Greenstein. He's got his own blog. But he's saying, I mean, he comes from the point of view rather like you, Martin, that actually mass immigration is a good thing. It's good economically. It's one of the only things that
I've
keeps...
I've never said that, Tony.
Haven't you?
No, I've never said that mass immigration is a good thing. Now, I'm just going to challenge that. Because you want to, it's your framing of this narrative debate that I'm in favour of immigration and you and your friends are not. That's not the case. We've got to discuss this rationally, and you've got to use.
Well, I mean, for example, you have argued over the years many times that actually migrants are good for the economy. Tony does the same thing, and in fact, he says he goes so far as to say that the more migrants, the better. He's saying actually it's brilliant because there are a lot of industries that wouldn't even be able to function, like the care industry, without more migrants.
Well, that may be true, but that doesn't mean you've got an open door to anybody. No country in the world has an open door policy on anything. And as your parents lived in New Zealand, in a second home for many years, you will know that doors are open everywhere for the right people. And of course, we've got all the wealthy people in the world can buy anything they want in Britain anytime they want, which forces up prices for housing for ordinary people here. Maybe what we need to do is keep out the wealthy. And then turn their condominiums into places where ordinary people can live. But we don't do that, do we? Because in actual fact, this country has always been at the centre of a global empire, and the global comprador elite from everywhere in the world, from Russia, from Colombia, from Nigeria, they come here and they put their kids in our private schools. Now,
you can describe my parents as the comprador elite. No.
They
have a lot of contacts and friends in New Zealand, and they decided that they wanted to buy a small bit of property, there, which is actually very cheap, and managed to wangle themselves a residential visa. I mean, they're not New Zealand citizens or anything. And
people should just stay where they come from, Tony.
No, why? Why? Well, you don't believe that, and I know you don't, and neither do I. So, you know, there is a purpose behind a lot of this, the migrants, which is to bring in cheap labour, and I think we can agree on that. But
because a lot of the people coming in have to go through a points system. Yeah, we only take people who've got particular skills. So that's just wrong.
In the care sector. Yeah. Anyway, so let's have a listen to what Tony Green said. It's actually not really about you, Martin, this. Let's have a listen to what Tony Greenstein has got to say about this.
That's okay.
Well, I mean, yes, I mean, they are part of it, but they are not the movement. I mean, you refer, I presume, to Stand Up to Racism, which is an SWP recruiting front, in essence. Yes, it's been active, but by itself, it wouldn't be able to organise very much. In Brighton, we had last night, 5,000 people came onto the street to oppose the threat to an immigration solicitor in Queen's Road by the station. Five fascists there to show their faces. I mean, Stand Up to Racism didn't organise that. I mean, they were a part of it, but they were a small part. But they're incapable of organising a mass movement. And also, I mean, they don't recognise certain forms of racism, like anti-Palestinian racism. So in Scotland, they're still marching with Glasgow Friends of Israel to fight racism. Absurdly, unbelievably, you know, marching with Zionists to oppose racism. I mean, it's like putting Dracula in charge of the blood transfusion service.
So what do you make of this latest round we here in Bristol had a bizarre situation last week where the police weren't even there when the racists tried to get into a hotel where asylum seekers were staying. Actually, it was left to Bristol people to surround the place and block it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the police are more interested in arresting and hunting down just the oil protesters and other environmental protesters or Palestine Action activists. They're not interested in fighting and opposing racists, so they have a lot of sympathy with them. So it's not a priority for the police. We know that. I mean, the police are riddled with racism and corruption and all the rest of it. I mean, even Baroness Casey described in a report a couple of years ago, the Metropolitan Police still institutionally racist. And that is what they are. They are there to uphold society as it is, not to support those who want to change or overthrow it. So, I mean, the police's response, of course, has been pitiful. And they've been very softly when they've been attacked compared to the way they react to anti-fascist and anti-racist activists. You know, they didn't go onto the offensive in the slightest. There was no CS gas or anything else. I mean, they just stood there with their shields. You know, I was quite amazed, really. No wonder so many of them got injured in the end. But no, I mean, the police are more interested in hunting down asylum seekers than actually defending them. I mean, that's the problem.
Well, so just today, up here near Leeds, the police arrested 22 climate protesters who hadn't even done anything. This was apparently due to an injunction brought out by BlackRock and Vanguard, who own this company called Drax, which burns trees, basically, and a supposedly sustainable power to put it into the British power grid. Now, we're not allowed to have coal, but I mean, what do you make of that? It's like Minority Report, where they're trying to predict that these people might do some crime in the future, so let's get them behind bars.
Well, that has been the whole purpose of the increasingly repressive public order legislation, which Braverman and Priti Patel introduced, and which Keir Starmer supported without any problems whatsoever. And so we're seeing an erosion of our democratic rights, our civil liberties. And for the police, defending asylum hostels, stopping the far-right rioting is less of a priority than hunting down those who want to stop climate change, which, of course, is occurring at a rapid rate, because they're there just to defend existing power and privilege. I mean, they are the priorities of the police. But... You know, people don't talk of police states for nothing. The police are the most backward and reactionary section of the community.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that seems to have come out of all of this, the race riots, I suppose you could call them, the far-right riots or football hooligan riots over the last few weeks, couple of weeks, is this whole idea of they want to introduce the facial recognition. So the idea is all marches, including... the Palestine marches, there'll be police there recording everything, taking pictures of people's faces to go on the record.
Yes, absolutely. But I suspect it's already happening. And who knows what they do with the information. I mean, there's always been police intelligence watchers at demonstrations. It is nothing new. But of course, this facial recognition is not an exact science. It's rough and ready, and it's particularly when it comes to black people, I am told, the technology is particularly inaccurate. But yes, I mean, they are creating the means to establish a police state. I mean, that's what the police are there for. There's never been an anti-democratic law restricting people's right to demonstrate that the police haven't liked. And of course, Starmer is all in favour of appeasing them and encouraging them. They even set up this Labour Friends of Police, this absurdity. I mean, the police are there to curtail our liberties. They're not there to defend our rights. And that should be, you know, understood by everyone. I mean, whenever you have a strike, they never arrest the factory owner for making people work in dangerous conditions. They arrest the workers on strike. We know that. I mean, historically, they've been an anti-strike force, I mean, especially in the great miners' strike in 1984-5. So, yeah, I mean, that's what we face, and we have to build a movement which can overcome this, because, I mean, there are real threats to our liberties today. Yeah. As capitalism goes into crisis, and we see this increased militarization. I mean, all this talk about how much asylum seekers cost. I mean, the real cost is the £80+ billion that Starmer is intending to spend on something called defence. I mean, I'm not aware that our country's under attack. It's about imperialism. It's about intervening in other countries. It's about supporting Israel's genocidal war in Palestine. It's an outrage. We don't need to spend £80 billion. We should have a civil defence force and leave it at that. Russia isn't interested in attacking us. It's us who are providing the means for Ukraine to attack them.
The Russians may be interested in attacking us, Tony, if the long-range missiles that we have handed over to the Ukrainians are used to attack Russian cities and Russian command centres, if there's evidence that British intelligence is being used, that sort of thing, and F-16s are used anyway. Look, that's a bit of a red herring, because I'd like to ask you a bit about Tommy Robinson, really. Who is this guy? The police just let him go with his passport, even though he was supposed to appear in court. And now he's popped up his head in Cyprus, and he seems to be running some sort of social media action by remote control.
Well, indeed, he's been supported by various Zionist groups in America, rich billionaires. His legal fees were paid, and I mean, he is, I think, a multimillionaire despite having gone bankrupt.
Well, can you give us any details of who these groups are this Zionist connection?
Well, if you follow Loki, he's done a lot of research. It's called the Middle East Association in the United States. But there are various rich, if you like, billionaires and right-wing institutes which have been pushing money his way. And Robinson is corrupt. He has a lavish lifestyle, although he was made bankrupt for making libelous and false allegations against a young Muslim schoolboy. He's a con artist, in essence. He's stoked the fires of racism here and conveniently exited to a holiday in a 5-star hotel in Cyprus. People say he's an intelligence cutout. I don't know, but he's obviously very close to the Zionist organization.
I mean, yesterday he appeared on Israeli TV calling for an end to the Hamas marches in London every other week.
Well, absolutely, yes. I mean, this is the refrain of the fascist right, Braverman, Sunak, and all the rest of them. They don't like marches opposing genocide. And, of course, Tommy Robinson is prime amongst them. So, yes, Israel is everything he would like to establish here. It's an ideal ethno-nationalist state. And that's what the far right would like to do in Britain and in Europe. That you base citizenship and nationality on the colour of your skin or the religion that you hold or what have you. So Israel, I mean, it's no surprise that neo-Nazis like Steve Bannon, Richard Spencer and so on, Geert Wilders, I mean, they love Israel. I mean, it's their ideal state. And actually, they don't see Israelis as Jews, to be quite honest. they are the new Jew, as the Nazis and the Zionists called them.
So that's Tony Greenstein from Brighton giving a bit of an account. I'll put the full version of that interview up on our show page tonight at thisweek.org.uk, where he also talks about some of the latest developments in the Middle East. Always incisive. Martin, he's saying that there are these kind of Socialist Workers Party groups, as you said at the beginning there, like Stand Up to Racism, that are sort of piggybacking on the movement. And he's very clear in his latest blog post that they are not the movement. He's in a position to pontificate about these sorts of things, though, isn't he? As one of the original founders of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and the first Jew to be suspended and then expelled from the Labour Party for so-called anti-Semitism.
Well, I've always respected everything that he has to say. I think his attitudes towards the police there, I can see where he's coming from, and I've had lots of run-ins with them over the years myself. But I think in actual fact, there's a tentative potential for dialogue here with the police. In Northern Ireland, the police service of Northern Ireland are trying to keep the lid on what's going on over there. And of course, as you can imagine, the loyalist hardliners that are really pushing this in Northern Ireland are, you know, the traditional allies of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, but not necessarily the police service of Northern Ireland. And of course, the police service of Northern Ireland is not the Metropolitan Police either, just as Avon and Somerset Police isn't the Metropolitan Police or the police service of Northern Ireland. That's the only caveat I would put on what he's saying there. We shouldn't have he's classically putting the Marxist argument there that all the police do is protect the status quo and the capitalist class. Now, in a sense, that's true. But if you live in a poor community, having a community police service that actually looks after people is not an optional add-on. Unless you're going to do it yourself, you've got to work with them. And that's all I'd say.
Have you ever heard of someone called Nick Griffin?
Yes.
Okay. Wasn't he from the British National Party and the National Front, I seem to remember?
Yes, he was. Somebody in the Robinson position some years ago.
Well, yeah. He came from, he was educated at the same secondary school as me, Langley Park School for Boys in Beckenham. Well, it's actually near West Wickham, as was Nick Land in my year, the accelerationist philosopher now in Shanghai. And Nietzschean philosopher, by the way. But Nick was there apparently years before us, so I think it was even before it was on the same campus at a different school. But what do you make of him? Because he's always been sort of tried to portray himself not as a sort of street fighter, like from the, you know, Ernst Röhm and his SA, you know, the kind of precursors to a world war where they try and get violence going on the streets to get rid of the political opposition, as more of an intellectual. Do you think there's any truth to that at all?
Well, obviously what you've got on the far right is a spectrum of people from what they used to call rompicoglioni, comrades in Italy back in the day, break comrades. And then you've also got people pretending to be intellectuals, and some of them are quite intellectual. Enoch Powell was a very intellectual chap. He spoke Latin, Greek and Hebrew, but he was still a racist, because some people are.
There's a spectrum, surely, isn't there, between people like me who have qualms, and obviously most of the country when they voted for Brexit, voted to stop immigration.
They have qualms about immigration, and
others that are racist. So there is a spectrum, isn't there? Anyway, let's have a listen to see what Nick Griffin's made, and see what you make of him afterwards, Martin. He's been talking this week. He says, what has caused the, what he calls, white riot?
Everyone thinking, oh, look at Tommy, he's caused all this trouble, he's helped spark this. Well, other people have as well. I mean, in fact, it was Danny Tomo, obviously, one of his lieutenants, who put out the fake news about the Southport slaughter being done by a Muslim who's just arrived off the boats, which has undoubtedly stirred things up, or did. It sort of kicked things off initially. But then the Muslim Defence League, very loose-knit operation, got its big push when in Middlesbrough, Nick Lowles of Hope Not Hate put out the allegation that Muslim women had been attacked by gangs of white men with acid. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's responsible for that. And probably most of all, Suella Braverman. Remember last November when Tommy and co were saying, oh, the pro-Palestinian demonstrators, the wicked Muslims, they're going to desecrate the cenotaph, when they never had done and never have, you know, haven't done since. So Ella Braverman, as a senior Conservative MP, was singing the same song and promoting that. And I think that, obviously, it wasn't the Southport massacre that kicked this off, because that was three little children horribly murdered, but the Ariana Grande concert bombing in 2017, 22 murdered, and it didn't have the same effect. So there's more than that, and it's a cumulative effect of the British people simply having had far more than they can stomach anymore, the elite treating the British people with utter contempt over Brexit. This goes down, a lot of it is to what they did with Brexit. Mm-hmm. 17.4 million Brits voted to leave Europe, overwhelmingly on account of the need, it was very clear, the desire to get a grip on our borders and to send our political elite a message that they had to clamp down very vigorously on immigration and on the problems that immigration causes. And instead of listening and doing something about it, the collective political elite, the Tory party as well as the Labour party, spat in the face of the British people, didn't give them anything at all, replaced Christian Polish immigrants with hundreds of thousands of Africans and Indians and a smaller number of Muslims per year. And everyone's looking again, focusing on the boats coming in at Dover. A few hundred every month. There's 4,000 a day come through the airport legally. That's what they've done with mass immigration. They say the British people voted to tell them to stop it. And instead, they simply said, well, OK, we'll stop the Poles coming in. You can have 500,000 Africans instead. It's an appalling thing. And that's really what has driven the British people to this. And yes, you've got people who have been wound up by Tommy Robinson and co, particularly about Muslims. And again, sections of the Muslim community in Britain has behaved very badly over many, many years. But whose fault primarily is that? People say, well, you know, that community should have got a grip on the groomers. The grooming gangs were from their community. They're to blame. Well, I'd have a lot more sympathy with that message if our community had done anything about the groomers. If some of our politicians, media, police had done something about it. If there were dozens of British fathers, uncles and older brothers in prison for confronting Muslim grooming gangs, then you could turn around and say that the Muslim community should have confronted Muslim grooming gangs, but they didn't. Nobody did. Mm. So they're all to blame. But all these things have been, you know, rolled together, and we've now got this state when Britain is very close to tipping over into what will be actually a civil war.
Well, I think he's exaggerating. I don't think we're about to face a civil war, Martin, do you?
No. But it's a possibility, and people should have the imagination to see it as a possibility.
It seems to me largely over the last week or so, you know, from the initial demonstrations last Saturday, it almost seems to me to be a sort of almost a media press concocted thing. You know, they had all this live coverage of Plymouth with very little really going on down there, and it's the idea is that the press really want to scare people, maybe.
Look. The press have played a role in this over many, many years. So, you know, the Tory press in particular have pushed all of this Islamophobic narrative, which is what it is. He mentioned the bombing in Manchester, Tony. You and I know, because we've discussed this on this show many, many times, that he was from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, that boy who supposedly carried out the attack.
Good point.
And the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group is in Manchester because the Tory government in the 80s, decided they wanted to overthrow the Gaddafi regime. So they brought these Islamic extremist Muslims into Britain and put them in. They basically put them in Manchester. That was MI6's decision.
And that's right. And MI6 also decided to bring back a load of ISIS fighters and give them British passports.
Right. So in other words, the Islamist extremists, which the nitwits like Nick Griffin think of, are just homegrown, you know, they're just Muslims who've decided to become jihadis. The whole jihadi operation was created in Operation Cyclone in the 1980s when Margaret Thatcher was the Prime Minister, and we worked with the French and the Americans and the Israelis to create an international brigade of Muslims to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. Now, and we recruited loads of people in Tripoli in Libya. They were the biggest group, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and they were headquartered in Manchester.
One of the most interesting things that Griffin said there was looking, you know, basically pointing the finger directly at Tommy Robinson for putting out the disinformation about the Southport killer being a Muslim. And also he's pointing the finger at Suella Braverman as well, saying that there's deliberate disinformation has been caused and spread on these social media channels, or basically people even just being phoning up or whatever, phoning each other up saying this is happening, what are we going to do about it? But a lot of it is simply deliberate lies to get poor white people fighting poor black people.
Yes, it could easily be a strategy of detenzione. Yeah, just like in Italy in the 1970s. And as I said on the show last week, the English Defence League and Al-Majer Haroun appeared simultaneously in Luton years ago when the East Anglian Regiment were marching through the town. Simultaneously they appeared. And both of them seem to have strong links to the intelligence services. I said last week about Kevin Fulton being Tommy Robinson's security advisor. And you sent me an email this week about Fulton. And how he went to a commemoration for all those who fought in Northern Ireland for the British Army.
That was fascinating.
And he fought in Northern Ireland for the British Army by being a major terrorist inside both the Provisional IRA and the real IRA. Now, what actually means is Brigadier Gordon Kerr was running agents both in the Loyalist paramilitaries and the Provisional IRA and the real IRA. In other words, the British Army were responsible for many of the killings, directly or indirectly, whoever was carrying them out. And this is why we discussed last week, one of the things that Starmer has done right is he's not backed this idea that we're not going to look into anything that happened in Northern Ireland before the Good Friday Agreement.
Well, it almost seems as if that whole idea of trying to cancel all the prosecutions that are still to come to do with Northern Ireland is to protect people like Fulton, who's been invited, as you said, to Westminster Abbey by the royal family to some sort of big celebration.
Army agent like Scapitacci.
Well, exactly. So they're still trying to protect a British Army killer who was involved in the Troubles. So, and also, I mean, you were trying to connect this guy up to Robinson, weren't you? Tommy Robinson,
yes,
too.
Yes. So I understand that he's become Robinson. I read about it some while ago now. He is Tommy Robinson's security advisor.
Well, that could be disinformation, couldn't it?
It could be disinformation, but it sounds right to me. Because in actual fact, most of these extremist groups are heavily infiltrated to the point, and of course it's justified, well, we've got to infiltrate the extremist groups. Although one of the things we've found out from the ongoing inquiry into the Special Demonstration Squad is that the very first time they infiltrated a right-wing group is because they were infiltrating the Workers' Revolutionary Party. The Workers' Revolutionary Party said to one of their people to infiltrate the National Front, and he was actually a British police spy, and he went back to his police handlers and said, well, infiltrate the National Front on behalf of the WRP and you can carry on working for us. But they hadn't got a single person in any of the right-wing groups. That was the first one they put in there. It was all directed against the left. All of it.
Well, that's maybe because the one side wasn't telling the other side what they were up to. They may have been infiltrating both without letting other people know about it.
That was the first time that any police officer had tried to infiltrate the National Front. And it was actually a WRP militant who had been instructed by the WRP to infiltrate the National Front, but he was actually working for the police.
It's interesting, isn't it? They're trying to close these organisations down, infiltrate these organisations, and yet somebody like Kevin Fulton is still strolling around on the streets.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons why they wanted to get this thing over the line before the Tories left power, because then that would have protected Brigadier Gordon Kerr forever. But, of course, it's increasingly looking to me as if a lot of what went on in Northern Ireland was more like what went on in Italy than I thought. Because it looks as if the British Army and the intelligence services, the deep state, were manipulating both sides in order to create chaos rather than stop it.
Now, this guy, apparently is working with Tommy Robinson, according to you, there's 25 charges to do with the Northern Ireland Troubles, including being one of the main people responsible for the Omar bomb, etc. Many murders, too. He seems to have been given a kind of get-out-of-jail-free card ever since the middle of the Troubles.
Army agent the whole time. Now, of course, that raises a lot of questions, does it not? I was chatting with somebody from the Protestant side in Belfast on Sunday night when we were talking about all of this. You know, that's why nobody in Northern Ireland was going to accept the idea that we're not going to look back.
And one of the fascinating
issue is that if they were doing that then, are they still
doing
this?
Well, of course,
now?
I think it's obvious they are. They're re-employing people who were used against the IRA, against the Muslims. There's been quite a lot of problems this week in Belfast as well. So you do wonder whether this is just the loyalist Orange Lodges being mobilised,
as they were saying, 70% of the people who've been arrested so far have already got criminal records. So I think in Northern Ireland, it's not the loyalist paramilitaries that are organising this. They've long ago decided that that's not the way to do things. It's actually disgruntled, you know, not very well-educated people.
Well, maybe.
But, you know, but of course, they're easy targets. I mean, the Muslims in Belfast, you can count them on two hands. You know, there's hardly any. So they're very easy targets for those who've got that sort of attitude. And, you know, as apparently was they were going past the Olmo Road, because this is all in the loyalist parts of Belfast, going past the Olmo Road, which is actually a nationalist enclave. The local lads came out to throw bricks and bottles at them as they went by, just to remind them of what civil war can be. And, of course, we did have a civil war in this country where two Tory prime ministers were nearly killed and lots of other people died. And at the end of it all, we managed to just about get ourselves through it. Mm. So the last thing we need is loads of people shooting their mouths off about civil war.
Yeah, no, of course we don't. And also, it does look as if we're going to have a United Ireland at some point soon.
Well,
so.
Yes, but nobody's holding their breath about that, because both sides have understood that we're not going to push that to the limit unless we have to.
Anyway, Nigel Farage from Reform UK is now an MP. He's also, you know, there are no MPs around at the moment, magically. All this seems to have just happened just before recess.
They did, in fact, recall Stormont.
Why haven't they recalled Parliament here?
You may well ask, actually. Yes, why haven't they? Maybe they should have done.
Yeah, well, I think they should. And also, it would have at least have allowed a proper discussion to go on about, rather than just saying what the government and the cabinet have been saying, which is, oh, we need to have facial recognition and we need to close down social media. These are the sorts of things. I mean, when the far right have been out on the streets in the past, there was no social media. But now, apparently, we've got to close it down.
Well, I mean, it's an obvious thing to say. I mean, the strategy of tension in Italy was designed by the deep state to essentially create a police state, a militarized police state. So they were behind the bombings and the assassinations, both carried out by the left and by the right. Same thing in Turkey in the 1980s. And, of course, behind it all is the deep state, which wants to control the direction of travel because they've got geopolitical goals to fulfill. You know, we've got to fight to take the oil in Iraq and all the rest of it. That's what really pushes policy forward, is what, you know, these big... big time people behind the scenes really want. And of course, they're quite happy to stir the pot and get everybody going. But that's actually part of the manipulation. And of course, the liberals now will say, well, if it's going to stop people like those rioters, I'm in favour of facial recognition technology.
Yeah.
See how it works?
Yes, of course. Yeah. Well, but it's absolute nonsense. And in fact, this kind of digital ID, massive databases of surveillance on every single person on the planet seems the way that they want to take us. Anyway, someone else who's been putting his oar in, even though he's an MP and is not able to sit as an MP at the moment, but he very much gets onto social media, of course, is Nigel Farage. And he gave us this week his recipe of how to stop the riots. It looks as if the riots may have stopped already, Nigel. Sorry, mate, but let's have a listen to what he had to say.
Do we want to deal with the symptom that we're seeing today or solve the problem? Dealing with the symptom will turn us into France, where these flare-ups, these racial tensions between the Muslim community and the French right flare up month after month, year after year, leaving big parts of Marseille and Paris effectively no-go zones. Is that what we want? Or do we want to actually solve the problem? And I believe we can solve the problem. We need to end mass immigration now, to send a message to people. We understand. We understand that a 10 million population increase has put massive pressure on people's lives. We need to deal with the young men, undocumented young males crossing the English Channel. Just today we learn that the Labour government are going to close down the hotels, close down the RAF camps like Wethersfield and Scampton, close down, as we learned last week, the Bibby Stockholm. They're going to put all these people now into government and private rented accommodation. So if your kids are trying to buy a house, trying to rent a house, or trying to get onto a social housing list, they've now been put even further to the back of the queue. Do you think that is going to solve any of these tensions, any of these problems? I promise you that it won't. We have to be clear that whilst we've always been open to genuine refugees, no one that crosses the English Channel trafficked in a small dinghy will ever get refugee status. And thirdly, we absolutely need to get all the police chiefs around the whole of the United Kingdom together and to say to them, start policing even-handedly. Treat everybody in Britain and be colourblind, absolutely colourblind. If you're operating stop and search in an area that happens to have a higher black population, remember, most of those that are being murdered are black. End this constant discrimination. End this diversity agenda. Treat everybody in Britain equally. And if we do those things, we'll remove many of the underlying tensions that exist in our country. And I put that to Sir Keir Starmer as a challenge. We're not even 100 days in to this first Labour government in 14 years. Remember, of course, he doesn't have much legitimacy anyway. The party only got 33.8% of those that voted. Only 20% of the eligible electorate put this man in power. He needs to start listening to the people. And the vast majority of people are decent, are law-abiding, support British values, believe that this is a great country, as I do, but are fearful. Fearful for the future, the integrity of family, community and nation. And I really believe we're at quite a perilous point. If we allow all of those things that we've built, defended over centuries, if we allow all of those things to come under threat, then we are in very, very big trouble. We will decline down the order of countries in this world. And remember, we're envied by most of the world. Our form of democratic government, the way we've always organized ourselves. It's one of the reasons why so many people actually want to come here. There are many, many good things about us. So look, of course we must deal with violence wherever it comes from and deal with it ruthlessly. But please, Prime Minister, don't use the narrative that anybody that is concerned about excess immigration, about illegal immigration, about population explosion, about change in our communities, do not allow them to think they're what you're calling far right, because I tell you what, they're not.
So there's Nigel Farage giving his prescription. So the decline of Britain is due to immigration, nothing to do with the total disgusting mishandling of the economy and mass privatisation happened in the 1980s, and it's now having its full effect by causing this massive cost of living crisis, making it almost impossible for people to survive, house prices as well. But it's all caused by immigration. Well, Martin, you'll be probably pleased to hear that Nigel Farage has just been going plummeting down in the polls. The political correspondent from Sky, Darren McCarthy, spotted some interesting polling about Farage. According to YouGov, the Reform leader's favourability ratings have fallen since the start of the riots in the UK. He's viewed unfavourably by every voter group in the UK except only Reform backers, that including Leave voters, by the way. His score with them has now gone from +7 to -4. Proportion of 2024 Tory voters that have a negative view of Farage has risen from 52% to 61%, and 47% of the public believe he holds some responsibility for the rioting. Nigel Farage's net favourability score has taken a hit over the last week, particularly amongst Conservative voters. So I'll put a link up to that poll from YouGov on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I don't think it's fair to say that migration is the problem. The problem is the people running our economy, isn't it?
Well, yes, of course it is, ultimately. There may be issues in the short run about managing this situation because we are where we are. We haven't built any council houses for 40 years. There used to be regular, we used to have a social housing sector to deal with all of this stuff.
That's funny, isn't it? Because that's the same time as all this privatisation started. Was there someone that pressed a button in 1979, 1980 that totally changed the way the country was run?
Well, of course, what it was is the change of a change of policy in Britain and the United States from the previous accommodationist policy, where we're going to have some basically social democratic governments. I mean, even Tory governments. It was the Tory government that nationalised Rolls Royce when it went bankrupt, for example. There was just nothing else to do, so they just did it. And nobody turned a hair. They didn't try and... I mean, lots of people in Thatcher's cabinet, like Sir Ian Gilmore, were arguing that we shouldn't be cutting public expenditure. This is a silly thing to do, as did all senior economists with the famous letter to the Times, 380 of them all saying this is a silly idea. But they did it, and they've carried on doing it. And at the end of decades of doing that, you end up where we are now, where the Americans, our glorious allies, let's not leave them out of this. They were the ones who blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which has now wrecked the whole European economy so that they can parasite, that they're basically vulturizing the European economy, including the British economy. That's the real enemy. That's the real enemy.
The Middle East Eye.
These are the people we've got to fight.
Last month, the Middle East Eye pointed out Nigel Farage is getting increasingly vocal about support for Israel. It says this article is Nigel Farage on Jews, Muslims, Palestinians, and Israel. His most controversial quotes: growing prejudice, says Farage, against Israel in public services. Farage expressed his surprise when Britain voted for a ceasefire in Gaza. There's a growing prejudice, he said, against Israel and its people beginning to run through our public services, said Nigel Farage.
Well, I mean, it's quite clear that the far... I think there's quite a lot of research on this by David Miller and others, that the far right is reconstituting itself around pro-Israeli positions. And, of course, Zelensky is, in fact, a Jew. And Kolomoisky, who was his, his Krisha, his roof, is living in Israel now, multi-billionaire gangster, basically. He was Jewish. But, of course, they both of them armed the Azov battalion, which is actually pro-Nazi. And, of course, this is now getting to be quite complicated.
Well, I'll tell you why. I wonder, Martin. We have to try and look at the reasons for this. And it might be similar because, of course, Robert Kennedy in the States is also very pro-Israel. I mean, he's been quite quiet about what's been going on in Gaza. And maybe it's simply, I mean, it's the Canary's got an article saying Farage is afraid of being branded an anti-Semite over Israel.
Well, I think he's trying to appeal to the right-wing core people who might vote for him or give him money. Yeah. You know, you want money, don't you? If you want to be a politician, you've got to have people funding you. So this pro-Israel position, I think it's a dead giveaway. And, of course, it's quite possible that Mossad are stirring trouble in this country, trying to set the Muslim community as the enemy. And then, of course, they try and piggyback on that and say, and that's the problem we've got in Gaza. These Muslims, they're just barbarians. They're not civilized. Yeah, that you can see where this is going. And it's pretty sinister. But, of course, the real problem they're facing now is, I understand, that the Russian transport planes have been landing in Syria, supplying weaponry ready for the big fight that's to come when they go into Lebanon. And also, same thing as they're sending stuff to Iran. But the world war with its two sides is lining up. OK,
I don't know if you'd noticed, I'm sure you had, that Tommy Robinson is now in Cyprus, as we heard earlier from Tony Greenstein, in a very nice, lavish hotel, because he was given his passport back and allowed to leave the country by the Metropolitan Police. And from there, it's an interesting... Cyprus is interesting. It's politics, isn't it? There was a lot of the Israeli soldiers, while they're on leave, they go to Cyprus on holiday, for example, don't they?
Well, that's because it's nearby. But, of course, they were let off for raping this British girl, if you remember. And, of course, Cyprus used to be part of the British Empire, and Akrotiri, the RAF's biggest base outside Britain.
It's also being used to spy on the Palestinians, and it's also being used for transport, as a transport hub.
To bomb Yemen, the poorest country in the Middle East. We are at war with Yemen, and the Yemeni armed forces see our armed forces as the enemy already.
I thought it was controlled half by Cyprus and half by Turkey. Are we in the Turkish half?
The Turks invaded in 1974 and seized by force the northern part of the country, never accepted by the Greek Cypriots or by the Greek government.
This is Henry Kissinger put them up to it.
Anybody other than the Turks. But there it is.
Yeah. Henry Kissinger put them up to that. It's a couple of good books. I remember reading many years ago a terrific book about that. His attitude was always, well, if they haven't got nukes, we can do what we want.
Well, the whole narcissistic narrative in Britain, like, we just want to be Britain like it used to be, but Britain like it used to be went all over the world creating trouble and problems in Cyprus as well. Of course, we fought a war against
the Greeks. Domestically, that's not what they're really saying, Martin, is it? They're talking about domestically where we had a welfare state, we had a very high standard of living. That's what they're talking about.
That was also, to some extent, dependent on the fact that we had an empire. I mean, the British Labour government in the 1940s put in the groundnut scheme in East and West Africa, where, in other words, they were going to grow peanuts so that we could pay off our national debt.
In the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, we had a welfare system. We didn't have an empire.
No, we did have an empire, Tony. In fact, some of the worst crimes of that empire in the 1950s. We had a welfare state. We had the national.
Surely this is just to do.
We also had the biggest prison camp in the world.
The whole idea of the welfare state was not to do with just getting money from abroad. It was to do with getting money from the wealthy in Britain. Indeed. And actually making sure that everybody had basic minimum standards of living. And this was a humanitarian socialist aim, and it was very successful. It was that was undermined, not the empire.
Well, no. Well, the empire gradually undermined.
It had long gone.
People in the empire fought back.
In the 1980s, it had long gone. The 1990s, it had long gone. Yeah. Anyway, let's have a little listen to Stephen Dorrall now. Actually, maybe we should, because we've been talking about Israel, maybe we should hear this week's little thing from Tommy Robinson, because, as I said, he was in, he's now in, ensconced in some lovely luxury hotel in Cyprus with lots and lots of bad vibes hanging around it, no doubt. He had this to say, because he's been interviewed, quite lavishly from several of the channels over on the Israeli television.
We have had jihad attacks every year for 15 years. What we've seen since October the 7th is the takeover of our capital city every single week by pro-Hamas, pro-jihadi groups who are encouraging hatred on our streets. And the problem's been they're unchallenged by the police.
The people have taken part in a far-right protest in central London this afternoon, led by activist Tommy Robinson.
They're trying to put the blame for this at my door. When the locals took to the streets in anger, the local police force and the government said it was the English Defence League. There is no English Defence League.
It's that the Home Secretary is considering labelling the EDL as a terror organisation.
It's total gaslighting. There has been no English Defence League for 10 years. There's nothing. So what it is rather than let people know these are ordinary people on the street, they want to create this bogey far right.
Well, they sort apparently a bogey far right, but he says all sorts of interesting things there, doesn't he? Apparently they're Hamas marches in London.
Well, I mean, this whole idea of what they're calling, Elon Musk call it two-tier Keir, talking about Keir Starmer. Incidentally, how disgusting that he's sticking his finger into what he thinks is going on. He says it's a civil war in Britain's inevitable. I'd say civil war is in the US is inevitable. And maybe people like you are going to end up like Mussolini. What do you think about that, Ellen? Yeah, hanging upside down. What do you think about that? No, you don't want
but
to.
But I mean, Martin, can we just look at this particular point? This is for an Israeli audience. They're being told by Tommy Robinson, who we're not seeing on British TV, but they're being told that Hamas is marching in London and the police are doing nothing.
Well, the reason the police are doing nothing is because these are absolutely peaceful marches. So this two-tier policing they're going on about, what we saw in Southport was mainly male rioters throwing things at police officers and trying to burn things down. What we've seen in London, respectfully, every week, as he says, is hundreds of thousands of people from all walks of life, Muslim and non-Muslim, trade unionists, Jewish defence organisations, all marching peacefully to demonstrate their opposition to genocide in Gaza. But Tommy Robinson has nailed his colours to the mast. We know what he's on that, and Farage and all these other people. World war is now going to be fought about this genocide in Gaza, and if we get through it, history books will be written. Those who supported it, and that includes Robinson and Farage and Biden and Starmer, are going to be on the wrong side.
To me, this suggests that Robinson is actually an Israeli asset. I mean, it seems to me I'm just thinking about the way he's being used on television. It's almost like, well, they don't want him in jail in Belmarsh or somewhere like that, because then he can't be talking to Israeli citizens and telling them that there's these Hamas marches going on, the police are doing nothing in London, and just basically lying about the situation over here in Britain, because this is all aimed at the hearts and minds of the Israeli citizens, making them think that the British are somehow behind the genocide, and that Hamas is somehow taking over Britain. This is all a paranoid narrative that Tommy is now injecting into the Israeli populace.
Well, I think David Miller's put his finger on it. It's not necessarily just the British deep state which is doing this stuff on behalf of the Americans. We've also got the Israeli deep state heavily embedded in this country, trying to create trouble so that they can then win their war in the Middle East, which they're not going to do, by the way, but we'll come to that, no doubt, later in the show.
Well, David Miller's been tweeting today about this. For those saying that Tommy Robinson may have been or may be in an alliance with Zionists and his financial relationships with Zionists are in the past, or the data is out of date, or the EDL no longer exists, which Tommy himself said there, and all the other variations of this line, here's one example. He said the investigation has established this. I think it's maybe even from The Guardian, this. So I'll put this tweet out on our show page, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. A US tech billionaire, he says, Robert Shillman, financed a fellowship that helped pay for Tommy Robinson to be employed in 2017 by a right-wing Canadian media website called The Rebel Media. And he was on a salary of around about £5,000 a month. So this is there is a lot of evidence that that these people are funding Robinson, and that he's just simply an intelligence asset, a mouthpiece, really, for the Israeli state.
Well, that's what it looks like, doesn't it? And it looks very similar. I don't think Tommy Robinson is Adolf Hitler, by the way, but that's exactly how Hitler was picked off the street and groomed by various forces who saw him as a very useful sort of a person. And we've got exactly the same thing going on now. The Israeli state, as they see it, are fighting for the existence of their existence. They are fighting for their existence, because at the end of World War III, they're not going to be there, I'm afraid. When Farage was going on earlier about all the Muslims in France and how tense it all is, well, then that's because the French invaded Algeria in 1830, and they insisted that Algeria was part of France until 1962. Now, you can't do that and say didn't happen and we don't want these people here and all the rest of it. Many of the Muslims in France, they fled because they didn't want to live under the revolutionary government that took over in 1962 because they fought for the French. So that's why they're there. And you can't say, well, we don't want these people here. Just as the Indian Army in World War I and World War II fought alongside the British Army. They were part of the British Army. There's a Muslim cemetery just down the road from where Paul Weller was brought up in Woking. And one of the first things he did when he became a wealthy pop star is the cemetery is full of Muslim soldiers that fought in World War I, and they're buried there in a cemetery. And, of course, nobody really looked after it. He made sure it was all looked after. Does Tommy Robinson know about this? Does he?
No.
Does he realise?
No, I mean, it just seems to me. Okay, so let's just go back. Around about the time of our show last week, David Miller, who we have on the show regularly, he said he may be able to come on next week's, well, let's just hope he can, or next week's programme. He says that the recent Islamophobic riots in the UK, Martin, should be seen as the latest phase of the State of Israel's war on British Muslims, who it sees as originating the protest movement in Britain. These riots are designed to punish Muslims for their anti-Zionist sentiment after various other methods to suppress opposition to Zionism by the State of Israel have been thwarted. Interesting little take that is.
I think that sounds accurate to me.
The State of Israel's attempts to use its assets and operatives in the British political and media class, such as Sweller Braverman and Michael Gove, to thwart pro-Palestinian protests, and of course they have successfully made Hamas a proscribed organisation, as they have Hezbollah, you know, so this is how these things work. To thwart pro-Palestinian protests have failed. Zionist counter-protests have failed to mobilise significant numbers. Sporadic Zionist thuggery and the use of other assets, such as Iranian secularist extremists, have also failed to intimidate Muslims. So, now, the State of Israel is weaponising its cannon fodder on the white nationalist far-right, who have greater numbers than either Zionist street thugs or Iranian monarchists and secular extremists. Well, it's an interesting take, isn't it? Saying, well, look, actually, this is just another step, really, in the home front here in Britain with the genocide going on in Gaza.
I tend to agree with all of that, because, as you know, Tony, most people do not realise how things are, you know, they don't, you know, they basically consume news on a superficial level. They don't really think about what intelligence services are doing. I mean, they're just there to protect.
Well, the intelligence services don't exist. We hear nothing about them, other than, always worth remembering, the Charles Shoebridge quote, that every single national press, that is radio, television and newspaper, home affairs correspondent, is a PR person for MI5. So they're touch constantly with these people. Obviously, somebody like Yvette Cooper will be extremely close to
and
the Keir security Starmer. Services.
Keir Starmer, very much so.
Well, it all depends, doesn't it? Because what they can do, the intelligence people, is they can select their preferred member of the cabinet and feed all the information to them to give them the knowledge and cut everybody else out. This is the power of information.
Well, it is. And, of course, people in Northern Ireland will know that, in actual fact, they're not always necessarily up to good.
Definitely not.
Tomlin and Monaghan in 1974... and killed the biggest death toll of the Troubles, the Garda Síochána are quite certain that the explosives were supplied by MI5. Has anybody from MI5 ever been put on trial for that? Made to go to prison? Go on hunger strike? No, because there's an asymmetry here. But we saw the same sort of thing happening during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. So they will basically encourage the loyalist paramilitaries to do stuff, direct them, give them information, and then, of course, they'll pretend that they're shocked by the results.
And in a way, a lot of this is to do with deliberately creating social problems. I go back slightly to what I was saying about making sure that people don't have enough money to survive, you know, food banks and all this. There is quite enough wealth in the country to make sure that everyone has a decent standard of living, but the government is deliberately making sure that more and more people don't. And so by creating these problems for people, you've got the possibility of then recruiting them into various different organizations, so where they can vent their grievances. So in a way, this is a bit what, you know, it's on a lesser scale, but what was going on in Nazi Germany? Well, you had horrendous mass unemployment, starvation, and Hitler stepped onto the scene and everyone said, thank God, Martin.
That's right. But if you think about the 9/11 attack, probably one of the most evil acts in history, that was carried out by the Western deep state. And, of course, most people still can't process that. It's too big a truth for them to swallow.
Well, I think more and more people...
The problem is that the Russian general staff, the Iranian general staff, the Syrian general staff, the Chinese general staff know what they're up against now.
They certainly
so it
do.
Doesn't really matter what nitwits in the West think.
When I spoke to Stephen Dorrell earlier this week, he's the author of the unauthorized, not biography, no, the history of MI6, which has got fascinating facts in there about the origins of the Bilderbergers and things like that, and MI6's involvement, and the involvement of Joseph Rettinger, who was from MI, he was the personal secretary to Sikorsky, who was the Polish leader in exile in Britain, and loads of stuff about MI6. I was suggesting there that Sikorsky was bumped off because he was about to have his country sold to the Soviet Union, and obviously wasn't going to be very happy about that during the war. But anyway, it's a fascinating stuff on MI6 he's done. And in the longer interview, actually right at the very end of the interview, he goes into all the more recent books that he's been writing, plus a couple that are planned to come over the next few months. Anyway, I asked him about, because he'd sent a letter into The Guardian, which wasn't published. It may have possibly have been published today, but by yesterday it still hadn't been published, about these riots. So this is what Dr. Stephen Dorrell, who was a writer of this MI6 book, and I think it was Huddersfield University, but anyway, a bit of a stalwart, what he had to say to The Guardian. What I'll try and do is look it up, actually, as we're broadcasting this, I'll look it up to see if it has been published yet in The Guardian. But anyway, here's his letter.
43 years ago this month, Michael Heseltine issued his minute. It took a riot. It seemed no one will issue a similar one now. Civil disorder is the language used by the inarticulate and those who say they have no voice. This is about racism, but it is also about so much more. Journalist reports during the general election campaign portrayed a divided country with serious poverty and a lack of hope set against the backdrop of the failure of Brexit. A brilliant but ignored paper, The Gender Backlash in the Vote for Brexit, by Jane Green and Rosalind Shorrocks, 2021, identified, quote, gender-based resentment by men as a significant factor. It represented a rejection of social, economic, and cultural change. It was not just about policy direction, but about the direction of society as a whole. The UK, 21st in the world in terms of GDP per capita, with continually falling household incomes, is a low-wage, low-skilled economy which simply does not work. Until that is addressed, quote, anger and resentment, unquote, will continue to grow. And I think that's what's happening. I think the kind of knee-jerk reaction from the Labour government is no different from the Conservatives in 1981 or in other periods.
Could you tell us a bit more about what Heseltine was up to that you were referring to there? And what?
Well, this was at the time of the 1981 riots around the country. And I'd have to say they were riots. I'm not sure that you can actually class what's happening today as riots. It's certainly civil disorder, but there are some rather odd things about it, like, you know, families turning up. It's almost like some kind of spectator sport that you stand around and see what's happening, and you see police basically doing nothing. But in real riots, which is what happened in the early 1980s, places were set afire. There was real violence between demonstrators and the police. And it was serious. Now, there's obviously serious aspects to this, but it is all a rather strange event, I think. And then you get, as I said, this knee-jerk reaction from the government, and you get the attack on civil liberties. It's only a week ago that Labour MPs were asking the Home Secretary and Prime Minister Starmer to stop the use of facial recognition. But now he wants to go much further. But in the 1980s, we had this kind of reaction. Heseltine was very good. He went and visited the places, and he wrote a memo which went to the cabinet and said, look, we have to do something because this is serious. There's serious problems in some of the northern cities and areas. There is a racial problem, discrimination, the black community. And it needs investment. And that's where it said it took a riot to actually get people to take it seriously and put the investment in. And I think, you know, there's a historical thing. How do we progress? And there's one view of history, which is it's incremental. We do a gradual kind of progress. But I don't think that's working. Or, in fact, it does take a riot for people to actually sit up and take notice and do something.
It sounds to me like you're inciting a riot there, Stephen,
unfortunately, this is so predictable. It shouldn't have taken place. It shouldn't have happened. Violence is wrong. But unfortunately, the system that we operate in, which is, to my mind, not very democratic. You get a government elected with a massive majority on a very small vote, one of the lowest votes in electoral history, and they do nothing, and they come in and they say, basically, we're not going to spend any money, we're not going to alleviate some of the major social and economic problems. So I think, unfortunately, these things are inevitable.
Yeah, so you've got this background of low per capita GDP and sinking fast, but then there's also this thing they sort of term the cost of living crisis, which is all those bits of infrastructure that Margaret Thatcher privatised in the 80s. Things like the water, the gas, electricity, you know, council housing, these sorts of things. The rents, the fuel bills, the water bills, they're all going through the roof at the same time. So there seems to be something structural. Now, what bothers me is this almost fuels resentment. And so if there's any excuse, people will, sort of come out on the streets and vent their anger.
I think you're absolutely right. I think the fundamentals are wrong. It's very difficult for ordinary working class families, or even moving into middle class now, to have a reasonable life. people are scratching around all the time to pay the bills. You know, the housing is simply too expensive. The rents are too high. Food is going up. And I think essentially this is a Brexit problem. It destroyed the Conservative Party. And now I think this civil disobedience disorder is a result of Brexit. Because Brexit allowed certain things to be said. And we know that behind a lot of the Leave vote was a deep resentment and a racism, etc. But it was also, you know, even deeper than that, as you said, about some of the economic and social problems going on. But they're not being addressed. And, you know, when you have a group of young men who have this kind of background, it is inevitable that something like this will happen. We've seen it so many times in history, you know, and it's simple things like the weather's good. There's no football on, and there's no youth clubs, and you have kids, young people hanging around, and they're looking for excitement, and they're finding it. And then I think the way that this has been dealt with by the media is very poor. This total focus really on social media, I think, is wrong. Now, there's huge problems with social media, and I rarely use it because I know, as a former lecturer on the media and journalism, the problems of it. But, I mean, in the past, it didn't take social media to get the far right or the extreme right or the fascists or whatever onto the streets. They came on anyway. And I think it's an excuse to blame it on social media. One of the differences, I think, this time is, in some ways, this is just totally unorganized. It appears in various places. They're not really large groups. They're not the kind of size of groups that rioted in the early 80s, or when I recall in the mid-70s when there was a battle with the National Front. And the police are basically standing around, allowing things to happen, because I assume they simply do not have the numbers of officers to control these kind of events. I mean, I run a film festival in Holme Firth, West Yorkshire, and we just put on Strike, the film about the miners' strike, and Orgreave. And you had thousands of police there, organized, ready, and taking on the miners with really vicious violence. This is very different. It's almost in some ways like play. Now, again, there are very serious aspects to this, but I think the media is just overplaying this. Because they've done that, they are inciting more violence and more demonstrations, because the far right now knows that there is a limited police presence, and you can pop up anywhere. I don't think it's that well organized. It's just, you know, a few phone calls and all the rest of it. I'll get a few dozen people on the street, and something happens, and it takes off.
Well, that's Dr. Stephen Dorrell, media lecturer up at Huddersfield University, and also terrific. I think he's also, if you go back long enough, he was co-editor of Lobster magazine along with Robin Ramsey, and then they had a little disagreement and went their separate ways. But he went on, I think, to do even better things after Lobster with his book on MI6, etc., etc. So, and I agree with him. I think fake news aspect to this, where it's the press is desperate to sensationalise what's going on, Martin.
Well, that's how you get clicks or advertising or whatever it is, if, you know, something exciting's happening.
Well, they never blame themselves for anything that happens,
do they? No, they don't. And in actual fact, if you look at what's been the daily fare in the Tory press in the run-up to the election, for example, you can see that, you know, these views, like stop the boats, has become a right-wing slogan, and, you know, but it was used by all the mainstream people on the Tory party. Nobody dared to say that that's a silly
slogan. And in the Labour Party.
Well, yes, but of course the problem is that because we've had all these wars going on since 2000.
It's organised crime bringing those people in.
All right,
Martin, let's not go down that road again, please.
I know, but it's a bit silly, isn't it? The people from Afghanistan are here because we invaded Afghanistan and we started interfering in Afghanistan.
And the same with the Ukrainians.
The
same with the Ukrainians.
We created loads of social problems right here in Britain.
It's a structural thing, I think. At least we can both agree on that.
At least we defeated the Soviets. That was the important thing, wasn't it? We got the Soviets out of Afghanistan, then we invaded, and now we've been kicked out. It took the Soviets only 10 years to work out it was a waste of time. Took us 20 years.
Stephen Dorrell, just to remind you, we'll have a full version of that interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, because he's an absolutely brilliant guy. One of those people, I haven't probably spoken to him for about 5-6 years or so, but he just absolutely rises to the occasion. And I'm not sure if he said it there, but he's certainly very much involved in his retirement in the arts scene up in the north of England, organising things like film festivals and this sort of thing. And his book on MI6, well, I'm sure MI6 don't like it at all. So moving things on a little bit from the riots, etc. And by the way, his letter was not published in The Guardian, which he sent to them, which just kind of makes you think, well, what is the point? Martin, what is the point of The Guardian these days?
Well, I mean, I used, it was one of the sources of information before the internet, but of course it's now become, the foreign affairs stuff is just basically intelligence service propaganda. Luke Harding is very close to MI6. And of course they've always been very interested in controlling liberal opinion. If you think about the CIA funding Encounter magazine back in the 1950s, so they're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. In fact, the people in the right wing press are they've got all their chums in the military and in the intelligence services, and the same is true of the so called left wing press. Keir Starmer, very close to the intelligence services, very close, been working with them for years and years and years. And, of course, he trusts them implicitly. They're the good guys, as far as he's
concerned. So the big call for facial recognition software, Shami Chakrabarty's actually been... this is the point of The Guardian. He's been in The Guardian this week, saying big tech firms profit from disorder. Don't let them use these riots to push for more surveillance. Do you think maybe Elon Musk, in the back of his mind, Martin, is thinking, gosh, there's some more riots. Brilliant. Twitter's going to get more advertising revenue.
Well, what I do find extraordinary about him, the white South African billionaire who lives in the United States of America, is that he's very opinionated. Very opinionated.
Well, he's entitled to his own point of view, isn't
he? Well, he is indeed, but when you're very wealthy, you're in a position to ram it down everybody else's throat.
You see, he tweeted some fake news this week about the British trying to send people who'd been convicted of rioting down to prison camps in the Falkland Islands, and he retweeted that, and he was spoofed. So anyway, so what is Chakrabarty saying? She's saying far right riots may not be the calmest moment for a reasoned debate about the regulation of big tech. The eruption of racist violence in England and Northern Ireland raises urgent questions about the responsibilities of social media companies and how the police use facial recognition. Whilst social media isn't the root of these riots, it's allowed content to spread like wildfire and helped rioters coordinate. Keir Starmer, I mean, back in the day, we used to use phone trees, mate. You just phone up one person, and then they phone up another five people, and they phone up another five people. It's exactly the same system. Maybe they should just cut off all phone lines and stop people speaking to each other on the phone, in which case, what will they do if they cut off the internet, they cut off the phone? Everyone just goes out onto the streets to say these things to each other. The point is, it's quite easy to spread disinformation by whatever means. Anyway, Keir Starmer has pledged to address, she says, online impunity and increase the use. Well, that's just because they haven't regulated it properly. That's why it says impunity. And increase the use of live facial recognition technology. We should applaud the former, but be very wary of the latter idea. Both technologies have profound implications for democratic accountability. She says, take social media. We're used to the adage that what's illegal in the real world is illegal in the virtual world too. But in practice, years of cuts to the justice system have left it ill-equipped to deal with the growth in racist and inflammatory content online. Explicit violent threats, incitements to violence have gone unpoliced, and dangerous and deliberate misinformation has spread. The great elephant in the room is wealth, power and arrogance of the big tech emperors. Silicon Valley billionaires are richer than many countries. Some believe they can buy current and recently retired politicians. Well, they can, yep. She's right about that. And see themselves as above both democracy and the law, Martin.
Well, that's pretty accurate, don't you think, Tony? I think that's exactly where we're at. And Elon Musk, you see, as you see, Farage's opinion poll ratings has gone down.
Well, her point here is that facial recognition technology is mass warrantless surveillance. So it's everybody in the country, the world, the town, the city is under surveillance, but nobody has gone to a judge to say, let's put these people under surveillance. Now, the idea is here, it's almost like bit by bit or a kind of entry drug into a slavery world where everybody is watched all the time. And if you start to step out of line, then someone's going to come and tap on your door in the middle of the night.
Well, that's certainly true, but in actual fact, it's already here. And so, in a way, we're talking about a stable door, which has all long been open.
There are, at the moment, quite a lot of restrictions on facial recognition. What Starmer's saying is, let's take the brakes off.
Well, what we could do, in actual fact, because these tech giants are monopolies, they should be nationalised. And there should be definite rules about what you can and can't say, and freedom of speech should be protected within those rules.
Well, some would say they have been nationalised, they are nationalised, that they're all run by the National Security Agency.
Well, indeed. But at the same time, private sector power is just as authoritarian power is just as potentially dangerous as state power. It's the same in many ways. It's the same thing when it comes down to it. At the end of the day, I remember going on a demonstration in Belfast years ago. We were marching down towards the cemetery, and the police were there, but they were standing way, way back, maybe 200, 300 yards away. They all got their faces covered, and all the Republican demonstrators were holding up camera phones to try and get a photograph of a police officer. And, of course, that means if they can identify a police officer, then that police officer could also be dealt with. So everybody can do surveillance. They do surveillance. And if we get to the civil war that Elon Musk wants, other people will start doing surveillance, because that's what warfare... Look at the war in the Ukraine now. All of these drones are keeping surveillance on everything going on all the time.
I mean, the point that she's trying to make, that she's probably not allowed to make in The Guardian, really, is that this has a whiff of fascism about it. It has a whiff of a massively authoritarian system where nobody has actually got any real actual right of privacy. Everybody's every activity, whether it's the money you spend, the places you go, the people you're meeting with, is all there on some database, a government database, which can be searched at will.
A private sector database run by Colombian drug criminals. The point is that you can't really get away from this, because the technology has now created this environment. Now, the state does watch people, but of course the state itself can be watched as well. Look at what's happened with all these people who've been taking photographs of themselves throwing rocks and bottles and stuff on these demonstrations. That's evidence. So people can go straight round. Police can go round to your house and knock on your door. But if there's a civil war going on, it won't necessarily be the police that come and knock on your door. Yeah? Think about it. It happened in Northern Ireland. It can happen again. That's where we could go back to. I hope not.
Well, it almost seems as if that's where we're being pushed, both with the cost of living crisis, as they like to call it, the taking away of people's ability to actually make a living, at the same time bringing in surveillance. I mean, it's almost inevitable that there's going to be civil disturbances.
Well, I mean, the problem is, underlying capitalism doesn't work. It died in 2008 and was rescued by the government. But, of course, it's a dead donkey. And, of course, ultimately, the capitalist system in the West is on the road to oblivion. And it's not going to be pleasant, the collapse of capitalism. It's going to be horrible. I'm not looking forward to it at all.
Well, we've had another bit of direct action this week, which didn't get very much national coverage at all. It did get quite a bit here, and it seems to me as it should have been every bit as well covered as the non-event far-right demonstrations on Wednesday evening, was the sledgehammer attack on police during a prison van ram raid of Bristol business Elbit, police officers were attacked with a sledgehammer, whilst activists also wielded axes, whips and other weapons. So a Bristol defence firm was ram-raided by sledgehammer-wielding activists during the early hours of Tuesday morning. Video supplied by the pressure group Palestine Action shows a van smashing through the fence of Elbit Systems Horizon facility off Bolingbroke Way Patchway, which is where I was reporting from about, obviously, probably about 4 months ago or so. They had a little camp outside there shortly before 4 a.m. Avon and Somerset police said over a dozen people exited the vehicle and began attacking the building. It's alleged some employees of the business tried to intervene but were assaulted with weapons, with one suffering a head injury. According to police, two officers were attacked with a sledgehammer during the incident. One of the officers was taken to hospital with injuries in her back, while the other officer was treated at the scene by paramedics after being struck on the back of the legs. Officers seized sledgehammers, axes, whips and other homemade weapons. Well, this is really just the police saying this, so until people are charged, etc., I'm not sure that we should be discussing what actually happened. The Palestine Action is saying that its activists used a prison van to smash into the building before machinery was damaged, including what appeared to be drones, and red paint was sprayed over the premises. Elbit Systems say nothing it manufactures goes to the Israeli Defence Force, and its UK arm provides equipment to the British military. It's an Israeli company, by the way. Following the ram raid, six people were arrested. However, the other attackers fled the scene, and detectives are now keen to track them down. So this is an audacious, you could say, raid. But they're saying that the sledgehammers, which were being used to smash up the equipment manufacturing, arms manufacturing equipment by Palestine Action, allegedly, Martin, were also then turned on the police. Generally these these sorts of actions are non-violent, aren't they? So in other words, they're destroying property but not people.
Well, that's been the case so far. But of course, this situation is ripe for manipulation by strategy of tension style manipulators, isn't it? Palestine Action isn't a democratic organisation where you can join and have a vote on it. It's a secret organisation, so and no doubt infiltrated.
Because this is so important, isn't it? If you can't do the non-violent direct action in the open, then of course you're going to have to become some sort of a secret organisation like Palestine Action.
Or Just Stop Oil. That Just Stop Oil guy was sent down for 5 years for climbing on a gantry, whereas the guy who punched a police officer in the face and got a string of violent convictions going back years, he got 3 years. So when they're talking about two-tier policing and two-tier justice system, there it is. Well, of course, these six people who've been arrested, they will, the police are probably going to get everybody here. It would have been so much better if they hadn't carried out any violence against individuals.
Well, we don't know they have.
Exactly, Tony. We don't know they have. All we've got is the police's word for this. And we've only got Elbit's word that they don't supply anything to the Israelis. It's, in any case, they're an Israeli company, and Britain shouldn't be doing deals with Israeli companies. Arms deals with Israel should be finished forthwith. In fact, the Akrotiri air base should be used to put a no-fly zone in over Gaza, as we did over Kosovo. But it's not being used for that. It's going to be used to bomb Yemen and to bomb Lebanon. And of course, the Nasrallah has said quite clearly that if you attack us, we're going to fire back. We're expecting to try and kill RAF personnel in Akrotiri if you're going to come and kill us. That's where we're at. And no doubt Starmer will go along with it all. But of course, it's going to crash the stock market, and we're going to have lots and lots and lots of problems with economic difficulties after that, aren't we? Still, the Israelis will have their war. That'll be good.
So what Palestine Actions are saying, do you want to shut down Israeli weapons factories? Join Palestine Action and take direct action to shut Elbit down. That's on Elon Musk's Twitter. Either apply for an upcoming training day or join an online course. So they are to a certain extent open. It's just, I suppose, that they form into small groups in order to actually carry out these sorts of actions, Martin. I mean, you could argue, couldn't you, that what they're doing is a good thing, because what they're trying to stop weapons being given to a government which is using those weapons to kill innocent civilians as part of a genocide.
That's right. And of course, when they go to court, these six people can argue, as the people who put the statue of Colston into the dock can argue, that there was a greater cause, as the Trident Ploughshares people used to do years ago, or people did when they were disabling the Harrier jets that were going to be taken to Indonesia to be used for repression in East Timor. But it's undermined if you have in fact been engaged in violence against individuals, because then it's sometimes that may be justified as well. I mean, frankly, if I was a young man in Gaza, I would be definitely supporting Hamas to kill as many Israeli soldiers as possible and to hurt them hard. You know, why not?
This week, the Daily Mail reports agony of mother of a teen who was killed in a machete attack. She learns that one of his killers will be released after 6 months due to prison overcrowding. A bit bizarre, isn't it? So 6 months in jail for someone who's been involved in a machete attack and murdering somebody, and 5 years for someone who's been on a gantry trying to help the climate.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not that keen on what Just Stop Oil do. But if there's going to be, and of course they themselves say that we're prepared to go to prison for their values. But nevertheless, when we're talking about Tutsi, there's far in prisons, the ethnic minority population is overrepresented compared to their numbers in the country as a whole. That's always been because they live in the poorest areas. They're the most deprived people. They're the ones, same in the United States. Far more black people in prison for the population than white people. And
this is an extraordinary decision to allow a murderer out after 6 months. I mean, it's not very much of a deterrent, is it, for a young person if they're only going to get 6 months in jail for murdering somebody?
Well, yes, and of course the question is they've created these 500 supposed prison spaces to put people in, but at the same time they were talking about having to release people because they haven't got enough spaces in the prisons. Now, what we've done, we've stayed this week after week. They knocked down Trinity Road Police Station in Bristol, state-of-the-art police station. And we've not bothered to build any new prisons, even though there's, rising crime, because it's just we don't want to spend the money. We need tax cuts. That's what we need, Tony, to get the economy going. Tax cuts. So the entrepreneurs can get out there and, sell stuff on the internet. That's what we need. Except we don't. It's rubbish. We're never going to get anywhere with that.
So should the Palestine Action website, palestineaction.org, be taken down by Keir Starmer? Because they're saying here you can join a direct action training day to stop the genocide.
Well, that will be a matter for the state. If they do that, then Palestine Action will have to find a response to that, won't they, from their point of view? The idea that we can kind of stop this police state juggernaut by just wishing it away is wrong. We are now moving into a very, very serious social crisis. This is just the pre-shocks, really. And at the end, we'll see where we are at the end of it all. Because, of course, the idea that the economy is going to tick over and that Rachel Reeves is just going to invest a little bit more and then the private sector is going to take up the slack, that's just fantasy. Capitalism is in a major, mega crisis. The worst one it's ever been in, and it's not just going to sort itself out. But of course, the rest of the world are very well aware of this. One of the things I used to think about some years ago is that, will the whole thing collapse simultaneously? But I think obviously what the Russians and the Chinese have been working on very, very hard over the last 5 years in particular is to insulate themselves from this crash in the West when it comes, so that they will be able to pick up the pieces. We won't be able to because we haven't got the tools to do it. We've got rid of all the government interventions that used to allow us to intervene. We'll have to reinvent them. But, of course, that's not how the rest of the world just thinks it's stupid, and they're not going to do that. They're moving away from our way of doing things altogether. The whole idea that allowing people like Elon Musk to become super billionaires is the future. It isn't. They're actually parasitic. We don't need these people.
In the news at the same time is a story from shepherdmedia.com saying Elbit Systems are to supply Iron Sting munitions to Israeli's Ministry of Defence in a $200 million deal. The Elbit Systems Iron Sting mortar was reported in October last year as being used for the first time in operations in Gaza, I say against Hamas, probably against civilians, as the country reacted to the Hamas attacks. They've been awarded a $190 million contract to supply the Iron Sting laser and GPS-guided mortar munitions. I can remember back even in the first Gulf War, they said, oh, they're laser-guided, these bombs. They don't kill civilians. And then being told by one of the pilots, oh, we accidentally put one of those bombs down the breathing tube for an underground shelter and killed hundreds of civilians by mistake.
Well, that wasn't necessarily a mistake when he's talking about the Alan Mirra shelter. I remember it. I mean, this is it. I mean, there's a famous Bob Dylan album called Bringing It All Back Home, which is about you can't go to war in other people's countries and create the kind of devastation that British governments have done over the last 20 and 30 years and imagine that you were going to escape unscathed. You're not. Eventually, what goes around comes around. And, you know, you can't really hide from it. The world's too small.
Ultimately, Palestine Action, they seem to have... do you think they're really making a difference? It's quite an amazing attack, this getting hold of an old prison van, ramming it through the gates, smashing it into the building, jumping it out and starting to smash up equipment.
Well, it would have been better if there'd been nobody in the building. And it may be that the time and day they were doing it in the middle of the night, they expected that there wouldn't be anybody.
Well, they probably know that there is a night shift on or something.
Well, this is the sort of intelligence you need to have if you're going to do this kind of thing, isn't it? Yeah? That's what you need to ascertain that before you set up. Now, I wonder why they would have a night shift on. Perhaps because the Israelis have got an order in, you know, and we've got to fulfil it. So when they say that they don't supply things to the Israelis, perhaps that's just a lie. Yeah,
Alexei Sayle said it, didn't he? At Christmas, in his Christmas message, they lie and they lie and they lie and they lie and they lie. And in fact, he went on for about 3 minutes saying that again and again. And I think we just have to take everything that the Israel lobby say with a pinch of salt, that they've just decided that they're going to use the whatever currency they've got with the mass media to just poison the debate and to try to deflect criticism and so they can carry on with their genocide.
Well, that's right. I mean, you saw what Netanyahu did. He went to the United States and got a hero's welcome. He came straight back and provoked a war with Lebanon and with Iran, just like that. And now, of course, British military personnel are going to be expected to die so that the IDF can carry on killing children in Gaza. That's not acceptable to me. It's an insult to Britain's war dead in two world wars. That's what that is. And we're now moving into that position. Nobody else is as close to the Americans as we are. Nobody else will be. Nobody else has joined in bombing Yemen. Just us, the Americans, and the Israelis. Everybody else has cried off. And, of course, the rest of the world can see that. And the rest of the world, our former empire, for example, they are all lining up behind the International Court of Justice to see Israel in the dock.
Do you know what Freedom News is? I'm not quite sure who they are, but they say Palestine activists crash prison van into Elbit Research Hub. This is on Tuesday. The activists early this morning on Tuesday invaded Elbit Systems' highly secure Bristol research and manufacturing hub using a prison van to smash through the outer perimeter. The facility in Filton's described as a research development and manufacturing hub for electronic warfare, land vehicles, simulation, vision technologies. Filton is a key premises for the Israeli arms company's UK business. Freedom of Information disclosures show it has existent export licenses for the sale of weapons to Israel. The group published a video showing a glimpse of how actionists used a repurposed prison van to break inside the facility. It's the first time this group has targeted the Filton site, while Elbit's UAV engine site in Staffordshire has been disrupted for 5 consecutive days by activists locking on and community mass protests. So this is a fairly comprehensive. I'll put a link up on the show page to this at thisweek.org.uk to this report. It's a pretty comprehensive one from these people called Freedom News. I've not really come across them before. The Filton site was opened in July last year with Israeli ambassador Zippy Hotevli in attendance. Products seen inside the factory are the same as those used in the Gaza genocide, including Elbit's Torch X command and control systems, the Thor quadcopter drones, and the NV-33 night vision technologies. Elbit Systems more broadly supplies up to 85% of Israel's military drones and land-based equipment, whilst its British exports to Israel mostly concern drone and aircraft components, military electronics, and targets its acquisition systems. And in a different era, or should we say about 2004 or 1990s, around about 2000, Martin, these people would have gone to trial, and if nobody was actually proved in the trial to have been physically hurt, they would have got off because they're stopping a greater crime.
Well, I presume that these six people will go for jury trial. So in a way, I mean, in the past, that's the way Palestine Action has operated. They've done the stuff and then gone for jury trial. But that's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is, you know, do it and run away and don't get caught, which is presumably what they were trying to do. But even if you get caught, you can then go to jury trial and say, well, you know, you can make the case.
And in those days, the Trident Plowshares group in those days was completely open. I mean, they weren't having to hide what they were doing. But nowadays, things seem to have changed. The courts are not going to accept that you're trying to stop a genocide. They're just going to bang you up. Whereas if you commit a murder, they might just allow you out after 6 months. There seems to be something very, very, very wrong with our justice system. I don't know who it is appointing our judges these days. Obviously, it's the King and the Prime Minister appointing these new judges as they get... I mean, I remember when we were here in Bristol doing a defence of the eviction order and a possession order over the old law centre, which we were occupying as part of Bristol Housing Action Group and housing several people in there. The woman who was in charge of the district judge who took over, only just started as a district judge, and she would, the previous week, had been working as the chief lawyer for the company building, you might have to help me out here, the French, big French energy company, Martin.
EDF,
correct. She was the chief employment lawyer for EDF at the Hinckley site, and that, there she was, standing in front of us as a judge. So who is appointing these judges, Mr. King? Police have arrested 22 on a separate thing this week. This is yesterday. 22 peaceful climate protesters at once, whilst racist riots spread across the UK. This is the Canary report on this story. Overnight on the 7th of August, police have arrested 22 activists mobilising for a climate camp at Drax Power Station in Yorkshire. That is the very night far-right fascists planned attacks, allegedly, against asylum support centres across the UK and solicitors. Police were pouring their energies into preventing a peaceful protest against the Climate Wrecking Corporation, which is, by the way, owned by Vanguard and BlackRock. Did someone mention anything about two-tier policing? Well, this is interesting, isn't it? So Drax is an energy company which makes its money from a power station near Selby in Yorkshire. They have a habit of boasting in their green credentials, claiming their wood-burning biomass power station produces renewable energy. This allows them to receive huge public subsidies. However, the Canary has consistently highlighted Drax is a serial greenwasher. They burn more trees than any other power station in the world. They're also the UK's largest single source of carbon emissions. Both Drax and the government claim the emissions don't count because the trees are grown in other countries. Notably, there's nothing remotely renewable about it. The wood pellet burning operation instead. Repeated non-profit investigations have shown the devastating environmental impacts of Drax core business activities. They're sourcing wood pellets for their Yorkshire power plant from native reserves in Portugal and other parts of the world. These are old forests. But anyway, so you're not allowed, it seems, to even have a camp where people are sitting around talking about how they're going to do peaceful, non-violent direct action against Drax. The police have arrested everybody, 22 of them, before they've even managed to get a tent up.
Well, yes. I mean, it's laughable that people like Nigel Farage go on about two-tier policing. I feel like saying, when was the last time you were in police custody, Nigel? You haven't got a black face. You know, you have been in trouble with the law and various things because you've been bankrupted a couple of times. But don't try and tell me you know about what police officers do or what happens in poor communities, because you don't.
Well, so what's going on here at Drax? Never mind Farage. What is going on here? Because this is a perfectly reasonable, normal, peaceful protest. But they're not even... And by the way, the Drax power station, apparently last month, managed to get an injunction saying that nobody's allowed to protest anything to do with their power station because it's such critical key infrastructure. Somebody has just gone to prison for stopping one of the trains that was bringing pellets, but it didn't stop the power station. at all. So we now seem to have courts which are prepared to give injunctions to BlackRock and Vanguard. You know, we're talking about surveillance fascism a minute ago, in order to stop any kind of protest at all. And when the protesters bowl up and they say, right, we're going to do some kind of thing to try and maybe block the gates or something, which the, you know, I'm sure they could deal with within a few hours, we're now saying that this sort of thing is going to be a thing of the past. You're not allowed to protest anymore. So maybe what we're going to start seeing is the climate protesters be driven to the sorts of tactics that Palestine Action have been having to adopt, Martin.
Well, it's Priti Patel's bill, isn't it, that brought in all these new measures, and of course in which the Labour Party is not government is not going to repeal. And as we go into the crisis that we're going into, you can bet your bottom dollar, as both of the previous contributors were saying, this is much more likely to be used on radical progressive protesters than it ever is to be used on the right. And that's exactly how it played out in Italy in the 70s. Mm. And they're basically preparing us for a war with Russia, a war with China, a war on behalf of Israel. And of course, the economics of that is going to be disastrous. And therefore, they want to control the reactions of the population when it happens. And of course, they'll do that by playing the game of, you know, allow, you know, as you know, in the past, the Special Demonstration Squad were actually involved in all of these radical groups and actually encouraging them to do silly things and then arresting everybody.
I mean, I was up north, up in the Yorkshire Dales a couple of months ago, and just for the hell of it, I thought I'd go and see if I could do a tour of Drax, because they advertise that if you have an email. In fact, they were waiting for, it's funny, isn't it, how these things work, but they were waiting for somebody called Tony. And they said, oh, are you this chap? I said, no, I'm not that Tony. And if I'd said I was, I probably could have had my tour. But they wanted me to email them. I emailed them. I got an email reply. And so I turned up, and then they said, oh, no, there is no tour. What are you doing here? Go home. I said, well, I live in Bristol. What do you mean, go home? So they wouldn't let me in, and they were extremely rude. They said, well, go and just, you know, they wanted me to not speak to them. They wanted me to go over to the other side of the room and sit down in the corner. And eventually, after about 15 minutes, I realised, well, we're not going to get anywhere with these people. They were really like some sort of mafia, very nasty characters at the security gate. And then when I went back to my car, they followed me back to the car. So I picked up my camera, started taking pictures of them, and they ran off. But they were an absolutely appalling, mega paranoid security there. And all that the climate activists want to do is to make a point. They're not trying to destroy Drax, burn it down or anything like that, which is what these people, there seems to be this corporate lawyers have a ability to scare the government, the police nowadays, into basically shutting down any kind of direct action against this particular plant, which is burning thousands of trees an hour, in fact more than anywhere else in the world, and it's supposedly supposed to be, you know, according to Millie Brain and people like this, green. But this to me is a great act that these people are doing. They're trying to draw attention to it, and in many ways Extinction Rebellion have drawn drawn attention to some important matters over the years. But now, no, all this lot have been thrown into jail.
Well, I think that it'll become apparent going forward that there is a two-tier justice system, and in actual fact it's the far right and their enablers like Tommy Robinson who are being given a free ride. And you know, we on the left have known always that we've been the target. As I said to you, the Special Demonstration Squad in the 1960s and 70s had no infiltrators inside right-wing groups at all. Although, of course, we know in Northern Ireland, the Loyalist paramilitaries were being directed by the British Army's Force Research Unit, Brigadier Gordon Kerr. That all of these things have happened already. They're not things that might happen in the future. So people, the possibility of all this turning into a nightmare is definitely there. And it's because, in actual fact, it's not even as if it's new. It's been going on for a very long time.
It certainly has. I mean, I'll put some links up to this hideous thing that these poor people have had to. I did put in a little thing on their X channel saying, be happy to interview them about it. It'd be interesting. Maybe I can try and get something for next week about, you know, some of the facts and figures to do with Drax, and this perverse idea that by churning, burning trees and forests. I mean, basically, in Scotland, where this is massive too, what they did was they built all these power stations, these wood-burning power stations, all over Scotland. And then somebody realised that these massive government subsidies for it, someone realised that if they were to try and feed them with Scottish trees, then there would be no trees left within a few years, and also the entire timber industry in Scotland, which is enormous, would be dead the day they switched them on. And so they started thinking, oh well, we're going to have to import these trees then. So they're importing them mostly from the United States to feed into these wood-burning power stations. And anyway, the energy that comes out of them is massively overpriced. The shareholders at BlackRock and Vanguard and Drax are making an absolute fortune because the energy prices are pegged to the nuclear price. So whatever it costs to generate, they get extra money because they have to have an electricity price which suits the nuclear generators. It's all a massive, massive scam, and all these climate activists from Reclaim the Power are trying to do is point out the public are being fleeced. So a few related things this week, also to do with climate stuff, I suppose. The electric car sales are tanking. We hear from Zero Hedge this week that in Germany there's been over a third drop in electric car sales in the last year, 37% in electric vehicle sales sinking. And so this seems to, isn't it interesting? Elon Musk, a few months ago, we reported on this program, took £50 billion out of Tesla. He knows something, doesn't he? This little latest bubble is gone, basically. The electric car thing is no more. Plus, we also have, I don't know if you spotted this one, Martin, earlier in the week, Google search is an illegal monopoly. It's ruled by an American judge nearly a year after the US government, they don't want me to read this. Suddenly a little thing has come up saying, no, you can't read this anymore. Oh, that's probably Google that's done that, isn't it? I can read a little bit of this out. I can just about see some of it. Martin, it is an illegal monopoly, isn't it?
That's why I said earlier on that the logical thing to do with these monopolies is to nationalise them. Because then you could have a set of rules which everybody knew. You couldn't, you know, as a citizen, you would have a right to certain, you know, opinions would be protected. Other people with nasty opinions could be shut out. And you run it as a public utility, as the bank should be run as a public utility, as water should be run as a public utility, as transport should be run as a public utility. We need a residual private sector, which is, you know,
let me just read out some of the details. Oh, it's gone again. Just as I'm saying that, some thing has come. I'm trying to read Wired, which is very irritating. And it wants me to start paying for it. Oh, God, how irritating you are. Right, anyway, I can read a little bit. It's Google is now 0-2 in antitrust trials. U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta ruled on Monday Google has unlawfully maintained its dominance in search by using anti-competitive deals to keep rivals from gaining traction. As I said earlier on, Google Play is now saying it wants my biometric data for me to download some rubbishy app, which I will then just want to get rid of. And without fear of pressure from competitors, Google has been able to charge whatever it wants for search ads, he said. The trial evidence firmly established Google's monopoly power maintained by the exclusive distribution agreements has enabled Google to increase text ad prices without any meaningful competitive constraint. In the ruling, it says unconstrained price increases have fueled the dramatic revenue growth and allowed it to maintain high and remarkably stable operating profits. His findings are arguably the most comprehensive modern examination of Google search business, which over the last 26 years has become a $175 billion annual revenue behemoth, which accounts for much of parent company Alphabet's profits. Google will appeal as it risks losing its prominent place on iPhones and other gateways to the web. In the meantime, of course, they should just shut the damn thing down because Google is probably, Martin, thinking, well, the fines is peanuts compared to what we're making from all these ads.
Well, I mean, they will fight to defend their position. Of course they will. You know, we're all becoming more and more aware of the fact that everything is rigged. It's It's everything behind the scenes is rigged.
Well, they boast. Well, I don't think that, no, not sure if they boast publicly, but certainly the Google search will, if you're searching for a candidate for a US presidential election or in the elections for the House of Representatives and Congress, they can skew the election results roughly 5% in each direction just by the results that they're giving you. So, for example, if you search for a Republican and they happen to be wanting to a Democrat to get in because he is actually quite pro-Democrat, Eric Schmidt, who founded Google, they can just show you loads of scandals to do with that person. So this is a very pernicious tool, and it seems to me that they've been rumbled a little bit here.
Well, they have. People are becoming more aware, are they not, of this kind of manipulation going on behind the scenes. And, you know, people are waking up to it. But, of course, you know,
not much coverage in the mainstream press on this. You know, the Google seem to have their friends, don't they?
Everybody's covering
a lot of the journalists use Google News Search, you see.
Yes, and also certain things, it's not your job to go around asking too many questions if you're a mainstream journalist. You know, that's not what you're there for.
In the tech world, another thing this week, the Global Alliance for Responsible Media is discontinuing after Elon Musk's X has filed an antitrust lawsuit against it. The World Federation of Advertisers is discontinuing the activities of Global Alliance for Responsible Media. Of course, it's nothing to do with responsible media. The decision follows an antitrust lawsuit filed by Elon Musk's X against the organisation. WFA says it plans to contest the allegations in court, but it's confident of its compliance. Well, why has it shut itself down then? That's unbelievable. The advertising trade group, World Federation of Advertisers, told its members on Thursday it was discontinuing activities for the GAR media initiative. Following an antitrust lawsuit, Stephen Lork, CEO of WFA, wrote in an email to members seen by Business Insider, the decision was not made lightly, but it's a not-for-profit organisation with limited resources. They intend to contest the allegation that X's suit in court. We're confident of the outcome. News came just 2 days after X filed an antitrust suit in a Texas court, which alleged that their members illegally colluded to collectively withhold billions of dollars in advertising revenue from Twitter. Now known as X. So GAR members include Unilever, Mars, CVS and Orsted. They're also defendants. So, I mean, actually, there's quite a long list here of these big companies. And they're saying that if we don't like your platform for whatever, we can punish you by collectively withdrawing billions of advertising as a little group. And now they've backed off because Musk has rumbled them.
Well, what we're talking about here is gangsters arguing over the loot, aren't we? That's what we're talking about here. Musk has been able to say to them, you can't do that because, you know,
Martin, I take a very different view to you on this. I mean, I see that a lot of our journalists and media is controlled by the advertisers these days, and they have an immense amount of newspapers like The Guardian. I remember chatting to Andy, who was a mate of ours during the old 9/11 Truth days in the UK 9/11 Truth movement, telling us he was working at The Guardian. And when they published an article by Michael Meacher about something to do with the, I think it was September 11th attacks or something, they got a phone call from a group like this group saying that we won't be advertising with you for 6 months now. So there is an enormous... you do wonder whether... and when you read a newspaper or look at a newspaper's website, whether the adverts are really the main thing, because the company needs that advertising revenue, and all you're reading about articles are just filler, and you won't read anything as an article if it upsets the advertisers.
Well, that's right. And the same is true for Musk. So actually, they're arguing about who's going to control our minds, Musk or them. I don't want my mind controlled by any of them, to be honest with you.
Well, actually, no, it's not Musk that's controlling your mind, is it? It's the people who are posting on Twitter. So there is a big difference between people who are chit-chatting. There's all sorts of people on there, Martin. There's good, bad, and all sorts. David Miller is very successful on Twitter. But it's the advertising which is leaning on the platform. That's what I'm saying here.
Well, I mean, but that's why the platform should be publicly owned then, isn't it? So it's not dependent on the advertising. And we can have an actual, genuine space which everybody can use. just like the banks shouldn't really be run by private bankers. They should be run by civil servants.
Tesco's profits up 160%. I mean, that's just a one-liner, basically. This is where we're going with all. This is more fascism. But some good news before we got one more item before we go to the break. Zimbabwe has replaced its battered dollar with a new gold-backed currency called the ZiG. Central Bank Governor John Mushavahanu took over on the 28th of March this year, and he says the central bank will not print money under his watch. So this is interesting, isn't it? So this is what Colonel Gaddafi was doing up in Libya, which caused him much irksomeness from the people like the IMF, and the gangsters turned up and had him. But apparently now Zimbabwe say, well, we've got quite a lot of gold around here. Why don't we have a gold-backed currency?
Well, I didn't know that. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. The dangers with gold-backed currencies is that it's too deflationary. And you end up with...
Surely a currency needs to be backed by something. Much better than having some sort of electronic blip somewhere.
Well, it's, and Bitcoin, which is, you know, apparently in Ireland, the Bitcoin miners have used up more electricity than the local authorities. I mean, it's absurd. I mean, gold is at least a useful piece of something to base things on. But, like, you know, this is a bigger topic. But the question of what sort of currency we should have is a big one. And I'm interested to hear that they're doing that. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, it certainly will. So let's have a listen now to this interview I did with Paul English earlier this week. He runs one of the websites that restreams us on a Friday evening. But he's also, he had a great little tale to tell me about how he had a bit of a revelation and a wake-up moment when he met someone from the City of London who he now believes may have faked his own death.
Well, I thought, what's the point of me trying to build a business and be jolly old nice if it's all ultimately set up to keep us controlled? And so on a personal level, I don't like that. I just, it's my nature to not like that. I think it's healthy to not be like that. And I wanted to know, I guess, the next step was, how did the world really work? So we ended up in a court case anyway with the Bank of England, which I won't go into. It didn't turn out too good. But that opened my eyes up even further. He was incredibly cavalier about it because he was familiar with being in courts and I wasn't. So I learned more. And then I really lost contact with him probably around about 2002. He went off to Europe somewhere. And the last report I had of him, I think he was found dead in a car in Spain. Or either that or he faked his own death. And that wouldn't, I wouldn't put that beyond him either.
But look, you just said there you were in a court case with the Bank of England, which you won't go into.
Yeah.
Why, I mean, that's the sort of thing, surely, if you're actually engaged in court facing the Bank of England, you may even find out some basic facts about it. You may even find out who its shareholders are. So can I press you on what the case was about?
You can. Well, you can, although it's actually embarrassing in a way. There's an embarrassing aspect, but it led to a lot of seasoned, really good information. Just to answer that thing that you mentioned about shareholders, just immediately after the case, and although it didn't go well for us, it didn't actually knacker my life, although I had to take myself kind of out of the economic system for the next 5 years, so about 2006. I actually used to call the Bank of England up to ask if they would give me the names of their shareholders. I don't know if you've ever done this. And it was, oh, I stopped after a while. I knew I wasn't going to get anywhere. But one of the responses at first was, well, we don't give that information out. And my next question was, so there are shareholders of the Bank of England. Well, we don't give that information out either. And I said, well, you already have, really, but never mind. And I tried three or four times. And of course, if you ask people about the Bank of England, they'll generally point you to some government statement. I think it's 1948 saying, no, the bank is a wholly owned thing of the government. This is complete horseshit, of course. But, you know, they're allowed to write and say whatever they want. The case basically was, how can I describe it? It functioned as a scheme, which they said, it gets too complicated for me to go. This is why I don't really want to go into it. The aim of it was to get people out of debt and to use the financial firepower that he had available by trading this paper for these select clients to take the colossal profits that you make. And they're absolutely ridiculous, okay, with no risk, which sounds stupid, but it's to do with a primary function, a fault in the design of the central banking system that they have to sort of shore up. and to take that money earning power and put it in the hands of the English. He was very patriotic and he wanted the restoration of the nation, which I've wanted ever since then. And since I've sort of fully became aware that as a group, we're being preyed upon by this fiscal parasite. And that was the gist of it. And the case basically was, this cannot be done. And the thing was that they were saying this, but it was actually happening and we were doing it. So they concocted a whole series of other charges up to disturb the organization, which they did. And in the end, I don't really know ultimately whether it was really true or not, Tony, because this chap, I worked out later, this is my view today, and I've held to this ever since, he was using me as bait to cause this court case. The whole aim of it was not for us to fulfill the goal as I thought it was, but it was to create a project that drew their attention and firepower so that they would drag him into court. This is what he wanted. He wanted them to take him to court. And when the court case was on, he never turned up over the 3 days. So I called him at the end of each day and said, "Where are you?" He said, "I can't be bothered to come in." This, of course, blew my mind as I'm in fear of the court system at this time. But he had literally couldn't care less about it. And he said, "The charges," later on when I saw him at Liverpool Street Station about a week later, I said, "Why all that?" And he said, "The charges are not heavy enough." He said, "They have intentionally put in a lower level of charge. He had information that he wants to produce as evidence to blow the government to bits." This is what he had at the time. This is what he told me. He said, "No, they won't allow me to present that as defense evidence on this charge. They know that I've got the information. That's why they're actually," it was more like a disturbance case. They were seeking to disturb him and what he was up to. So they were aware of certain things. And it gets very, it's comedic in a way as well. I mean, there's, you've heard about these nuclear bunkers that were built around London after World War II, you know, for the Cold War and all that kind of stuff. Well, he had one out in a farmer out in Essex Field, which is where he was originally from. Had one, and he had a lot of fiscal resources down there. He had some crazy ideas in a way. I mean, you're probably aware that the mafia, I don't know if they still do, but the mafia in London, they've got tunnels stuffed with cash all over the place, or they used to have. I guess maybe they're having a problem with Bitcoin, but yeah, it's too labyrinthine a tale to cover in 15 minutes.
Okay, well, that's fine. What's the take home for listeners? You know, what did you learn from all this? How can you adjust your life to cope with the fact that the financial system is so fraudulent?
It's a very good question, and it's something I've been struggling with for a long time, because if you look in history, which I've spent a lot of time doing ever since, you see that there are very few incidents in history where the monetary system has been overturned for long. It has been overturned and transformed for short periods of time, and in nearly all cases, the results, certainly for the population, are spectacularly positive. They're incredibly positive. And so the individuals that have ever done that are demonized. And the ones that are most on a national or a governmental level that have been demonized the most, the one within recent living memory is Gaddafi in Libya, who was doing exactly that. He took the resources of Libya and made them available in great deal to the actual Libyan people. They were living great. You got married. You got $50,000. You didn't pay interest on the mortgage on your house. You put the pipeline in. They were growing more food. Education was free. If you studied overseas, they'd pay also. It was just as you and I think most people would imagine a truly cooperative nation working. And I'm not saying it was perfect, but it's way, way better than anybody else. And what happened to him? He was dealt with in the most savage of fashion. And, of course, the first thing that happened when the United Nations or whoever it was that Hillary Clinton sent down there did was to go into the Treasury buildings and seize all the documents, which were basically the debts that the West owed Libya for their oil, so to make sure that they couldn't cash them in. That's what, you know, in nearly all cases, all the wars are bankers' wars.
So that's Paul English. Full interview with him be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk and on the app, of course, later this evening. Martin, he sounds like there is a sort of class of people out there that have access to almost like esoteric information about how the City of London really works.
Well, I mean, obviously, that's kind of it's intriguing, but it's anecdotal, let's put it that way. Obviously, Gaddafi's downfall wasn't anecdotal. And when he was saying that, I was thinking about what happened to Abraham Lincoln, because, of course, he paid for the North's victory in the American Civil War by printing greenbacks. So he didn't, you know, he wasn't going to borrow the money from the banking system. And he wanted to carry on with that when the war ended. And that's probably got a lot to do with why he was assassinated, because the bankers didn't want that to happen. And I'm familiar with the idea that all wars are bankers' wars. And it's kind of, you know...
Justin Walker, our old pal from the 9/11 Truth, who chaired it for a while, he brought up this whole thing of the Bradbury Pound, which was used in the First World War. And then, of course, as soon as it, in order to keep the British economy going and the war going, but then, of course, as soon as the war was coming to an end, they got rid of that. But, I mean, this is the, there seems to be something absolutely wrong at the heart of the financial system, not just the people running it, but they occasionally they have to allow a bit of real money to be produced. And of course, one of the major principles is that people themselves need to have access to their own wealth, not just by some sort of, an entry in a log somewhere controlled by a bank.
Well, I mean, obviously, there are big issues here to discuss. But I mean, the financial system, financialization is not necessarily a good thing.
Isn't it a religion? It's become a religion almost, financialising everything.
Yes, because it's presented as this is the future, whereas in actual fact there's a recent study by the IMF, no less, that shows that the more financialised your economy is, the lower the growth. Countries with a less deep financial system actually do better.
Growth isn't necessarily even good, is it? Because if you can double what everyone is paying in rent every week, you're massively increasing growth, but you're sending everybody into massive misery and poverty.
That's right. This is what Michael Hudson points out, is that the GNP figures, every time somebody has to pay a credit card debt, that is counted as something productive, but it isn't. In actual fact, a lot of what goes on in Western economies now is what used to be called non-productive investment. It's speculative. It doesn't produce anything. And ultimately, you can have a bit, as Keynes pointed out in the 30s, you can have a bit of speculation in a system, like a few bubbles rising to the top of a pint of beer or something like that. But if the whole thing is just bubbles, then it doesn't work.
It's like Musk and his electric...
That's where we've got to.
Musk and his electric vehicle...
Musk
and his electric vehicle bubble, you know, this sort of thing.
Well, that's right. So in other words, he's made a load of money out of that idea of electric vehicles, and he walks away with all that money, but he doesn't have to make any electric vehicles as such, because that's too hard. The Chinese, on the other hand, are making electric vehicles and selling them, but they're not allowed to sell their vehicles, because otherwise they would undercut the potential for, Westerners to make money out of it and all the rest of it. I mean, this is the competition that China represents to the Western way of doing things. They don't run it like that, and that's why they've got to be taken down.
And like I say, Paul English's full interview with him and Stephen Dorrell, etc., they will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later tonight.
The press is down, the boss boss ain't here, he got none for a while. Say that vanity got the best of him, but he sure left here in style. By the way, that's a cute hat, and it smiles so hard to resist. But what's a sweetheart like you doing in a dump like this? You know, I once knew a woman who looked like you. She wanted a whole man, not just a half. She used to call me sweet daddy when I was only a child. You kind of remind me of her when you laugh. In order to deal in this game, got to make the queen disappear. It's done with a flick of the wrist. What's a sweetheart like you doing in a dump like this? You know a woman like you should be at home. That's where you belong. Taking care of somebody nice who don't know how to do you wrong. Just how much abuse will you be able to take? Well, there's no way to tell by that first kiss. What's a sweetheart like you doing in a dump like this? You can hear them tires squeal. You could be known as the most beautiful woman who ever crawled across cut glass to make a deal. You know news of you has come down the line even before you came to the door. They say in your father's house there's many mansions, each one of them got a fireproof floor. People are jealous of you. They smile to your face, but behind your back they hiss. What's a sweetheart like you doing in a dump like this? Got to be an important person to be in here, honey. Got to have done some evil deed. Got to have your own helm when you come in the door. Got to play your harp until your lips bleed. Patriotism is the last refuge to which a scoundrel clings. Steal a little and they throw you in jail. Steal a lot and they make you king. There's only one step down from here, baby. It's called the land of permanent bliss. What's a sweetheart like you?
In the second reading, John urges his listeners to walk in the light of God and in fellowship with Jesus Christ. A reading from the first letter of John, chapter 1, beginning at the first verse. We declare to you what was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched with our hands concerning the word of life. This life was revealed, and we have seen it, and testify to it, and declare to you the eternal life that was with the Father and was revealed to us. We declare to you what we have seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us. And truly, our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. We are writing these things so that our joy may be complete. This is the message we have heard from him and proclaim to you, that God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. If we say that we have fellowship with him while we are walking in darkness, we lie and do not do what is true. But if we walk in the light, as he himself is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus, his Son, cleanses us from all sin. If we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. If we confess our sins, he who is faithful and just will forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. If we say that we have not sinned, we make him a liar, and his word is not in us.
But it's threatening about divesting and wanting peace. The problem isn't the protests, it's what they're protesting. It goes against what our country is funding. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. When I was 7, I learned a lesson from Cuban Eazy-E. What was it again? Oh yeah, the police. Actors and badges protecting property in a system that was designed by white supremacy. But the people are in the streets. You can pay off Meta, you can't pay off me. Politician, to serve by any means. APAC, Koofy, and all the companies. You see we sell fear around the land of the free. But this generation here is about to cut the strings. You can ban TikTok, take us out the algorithm. But it's too late, we've seen the truth, we bear witness. Seen the rubble, the buildings, the mothers and the children. And all the men that you murdered, and then we see how you spin it. Who gets the right to defend and who gets the right of resistance? It's always been about dollars and the color of your pigment. But white supremacy is finally on blast, screaming free Palestine to their home at last. We see the lies and I'm claiming it's anti-Semitic to be anti-Zionist. I've seen Jewish brothers and sisters out there inviting in solidarity and screaming free Palestine with them organizing and learning and finally cutting ties with the state that's gotta rely on apartheid system to uphold and occupy and violent history been repeating for the last 75. The NECPA never ended, the colonizer lied. The students in tents posted on the lawn, occupying the quad is really against the law. And a reason to call and the police and their squad. Where this genocide land and your definition, huh? Destroying every college in Gaza and every mosque. Pushing everyone in the rock and dropping bombs. The blood is on your hands, Biden, we can see it all. And no, I'm not voting for you in the fall. Undecided, you can't twist the truth. The people out here united. Never be defeated when freedom's on the horizon. Yet the music industry's quiet, complicit in their platform of silence. What happens to the artist? What you gotta say? If I was on a label, you could drop me today. I'll be fine with it, cause the heart fed my page. I want a ceasefire, a response from Drake. What you willing to risk? What you willing to give? What if you were in Gaza? What if those were your kids? If the West was pretending that you didn't exist, you want the world to stand up, and the students finally did. Let's go.
So that's the artist, I believe, is called Hinds Halt, Hinds, H-I-N-D-S, H-A-L-L, Students Stand Up. That's from earlier this year. Before that, you heard Bob Dylan from his Infidels album, What's a Sweetheart Like You Doing in a Place Like This? Terrific. Before that, we had some prayer. It was a New Testament reading from Worcester Cathedral. But to start, we had Guildford Cathedral with some kids singing At the Name of Jesus. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Particularly powerful. One of the things about that song we heard at the end there, I mean, what I keep hearing is, well, back in the 1960s and 70s, we had loads of protest songs. We don't have any anymore. No, there are protest songs out there, folks. It's just that they're not playing them to us. The mass media is not... and the music industry is not getting them out there. There's actually quite a bit around. So here's just a general appeal. If you know of any stuff like that by the Heinz Hall, whoever Heinz Hall is, do send it to me. I'll be more than happy to play it. Excellent. I had to bleep quite a lot out of that, but that's a fantastic tune. And you can hear, if you track down the unbleeped version, I will put a full version of that with no bleeps. maybe I'll put the bleeped one too up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk tonight, so you can blast that out of your car over the weekend, as I like to do quite often. Anyway, Martin, back to the Palestine, etc. But before that, I think we need to talk a bit about Russia, don't we? Because there's been an attack this week. I was looking at it thinking this looks like the Battle of the Bulge in World War II, which was the last gasp of the Nazis. But into the Kursk region of Russia, the Ukrainians have stepped.
Yes, I mean, obviously, I've been reading a lot about this to see what's going on. They've attacked what was, you know, Russia proper. I mean, they've been doing this all along. They've been attacking in Belgrade. And, of course, you know, the Russians are well aware that these terrorist attacks, like on the Crocus Theatre, they think that that was definitely Western intelligence services behind that. So, in a sense, they're not that surprised. I think what the Ukrainian side are doing is by trying to, you know, there's no real military point to this. They're doing it because they haven't really got anything else they can do. They're trying to do stuff now so that the West will carry on giving them weaponry so that they can carry on the fight. But and that basically means the people around Zelensky carrying on stealing money. But it's desperation stuff. I mean, obviously the Russians didn't have a load of big forces up against the border there, because if you mass big forces these days, they come under attack. So you have to disperse everybody all over.
Well, no, hang on. It's just because it wasn't considered to be too dangerous. They have a line along there, but it's fairly thin.
Yes, that's right. But I mean, the point is, if they had a load of troops there, they would come under attack. And what the Ukrainians have done is they managed to sneak all these troops in. It's a relatively small incursion. I'm looking at the numbers involved, and compared to the numbers of Ukrainians who are dying along the front, it's minuscule. And they've also been hammered because they've got no air cover. So they can charge forward and they can grasp, you know, seize what is virtually empty territory in terms of military. Now, there's people living there, but there's not much military stuff in the way.
I don't know if you're a Daily Mail reader, but the Daily Mail is saying the Kremlin has accused Britain of participating in Ukraine's mini invasion of Russia as the Ukrainian military convoy of tanks and soldiers pour over the border. Russia accused Britain of being behind Ukraine's remarkable mini invasion that has stunned Vladimir Putin. Thousands of Ukrainian, I wonder if British taxpayers' money has gone towards this, who knows, but thousands of Ukrainian soldiers charged across the Russian border this week for the first time since the conflict began. Since then, these troops have reinforced their positions, suggesting Ukraine intends to hold the territory it seized. The move, described last night by a UK intelligence officer, former one, as a masterstroke, could prove a game changer in future peace talks. So they are talking it up. Abalbi Shigazgoskev, gosh, very difficult name to pronounce that one, member of the State Duma Committee, told Russian media Britain participated in all these sorties. English has been heard. The Kursk region where the incursion took place is critical for Russian gas supplies. So if they've been hearing English being spoken, that doesn't necessarily mean that Britain is behind this, does it?
Well, it doesn't, but I think that's the Russian suspicion, is that the British have been particularly forward in putting themselves forward to be the leaders of the war against Russia. It's not really in our national interest at all, but that's where we've ended up. And, of course, the lots of people in this assault aren't, in fact, Ukrainians. Some of them are English, loads of them are French, there's loads of Poles and Georgians. They've got a picture of a Georgian, the Georgian Legion, carrying his flag at the beginning. This is essentially a political manoeuvre, it's not really got that much military significance. And from a military point of view, the stuff I've been reading is saying, well, these are the last reserves that the Ukrainians have got. And they've thrown them into this, you know, what is essentially a Hail Mary pass to try and change the, you know, the losing wicket that they're on. But I don't think it's going to change anything because, of course, they're being mashed to pieces. They've got no air cover. So, you know, they've lost loads and loads of military vehicles and quite a lot of their personnel.
Apparently, Putin has faced a dilemma, according to the Daily Mail, to accept such a strategically damaging and embarrassing loss of territory or pull together another force capable of dislodging the Ukrainian soldiers. The second option would be to require thousands of Russian soldiers to be withdrawn from the 700-mile front line in eastern Ukraine, which would inevitably weaken the positions. Last night, the former British intelligence officer, Philip Ingram, said the mini-invasion targeted an area where Russian defences are weak. Ukraine has embarrassed Putin and the Russian military. They brought the war to ordinary Russians and set the conditions for negotiations. It's too early to tell Ukraine's ultimate objectives, but on the surface, it could be a masterstroke if they can continue to advance and hold off the Russian counterattacks. Now, obviously there are quite a lot of Russian civilians who have to up sticks during all this, Martin.
Well, I think that they're either up sticks or they sit tight and wait to be rescued, don't they?
If Ukrainian soldiers are streaming through your villages and towns, can you?
Well, the thing is, you can try and run or you can stay. It's a choice for the people who are there, isn't it? You might be safer off just staying in your house while this is going on. Or you could try and run to Russia proper.
They're having all sorts of trouble recruiting new soldiers in Ukraine as well. Warren Thornton posted a hilarious video yesterday, or it was this morning maybe. I don't know if you've seen this one, Martin, of a young Ukrainian lad who's obviously very fit. He's looking at his phone and there is a Ukrainian recruiter running after him, trying to catch him to recruit him into the army. And he's filming this and live streaming it and saying, well, it's really good. We've got these guys who help us to do our jogging training now. And in the meantime, he's filming some guy in an army uniform in Ukraine who's trying to catch him to force him, press gang him into the army. But he's running and just poking fun at this guy who's running behind him who can't actually quite catch up with him.
Well, I mean, obviously lots of Ukrainians Ukrainian men of military age are trying to get out of the Ukraine because they don't want to be thrown into this. This war is over. The Ukraine's just got to throw in the towel. But, of course, the Western powers do not want to accept defeat, which is why you've got ex-British intelligence officers saying what a masterstroke it is, undoubtedly because MI6, the Russians are probably right about this, they're behind this. Most of the intelligence stuff that the Ukrainians do, the British have been heavily involved in it, from the assassinations of Givi, Motorola, Zakhachenko in 2017. The British haven't got lots of big military forces, but what we have got is very tricksy special forces led by very, very devious intelligence officers who all went to Oxford and Cambridge and know an awful lot about
the Pentagon is saying it supports Ukraine using US weapons in Russia's Kursk Oblast. Ukraine has launched the offensive into Russian territory on Tuesday. The Pentagon said on Thursday Ukraine is allowed to use US weapons in its offensive actually in Russia itself. Pentagon spokesman Sabrina Singh was asked if Ukraine's use of US provided weapons in Kursk was consistent with American policy. Yes, it is consistent, she was told. She framed the attack on Kursk as a defensive operation against Russian attacks from over the border, saying the US has supported Ukraine from the beginning to defend themselves against attacks that are coming across the border. For the first 2 years of the war, the US provided Ukraine it's prohibited Ukraine from striking Russian territory, but recently lifted that restriction. Now, this could make a big difference, couldn't it? The Russians are hoping that there's going to be negotiations and an end to all of this, Martin, but it doesn't look like that's coming anytime soon. In fact, the opposite.
Well, I think it's the West that's talking up negotiations now, because they're saying, I mean, this is being presented...
They're talking about negotiations. They don't really want them, surely.
The West is the one who is pushing the idea of negotiations as a cover for the fact for just continuing the war. But you've got to understand that on the Russian side, there's no willingness to negotiate with people who don't stick to deals they've already done. And therefore, there's, you know, the West at some point is going to say, now we want to negotiate with you, Russia. And the Russians are going to say, you've had your chances to negotiate. We are now going to finish the war. And what's also happened as a result of what's happened in Kursk is Putin, as I said earlier in the show, there have been big Antonov planes taking war material into Damascus and into Tehran. And that is because, as Putin said, if you're going to start attacking Russia proper and kill our people, then we are going to take the gloves off and we're going to give our top-level kit to the people who are fighting you. Like the Houthis, for example, in the Red Sea. Let's give them some Russian missiles so they really can sink a British destroyer with all hands on deck. Yeah, because that's what it comes
down to. RT, we're not allowed to hear from, but they are saying today Ukraine is taking heavy losses in Kursk. Kiev has lost nearly 1,000 soldiers and over 100 armoured vehicles over the past few days. Russia's defence ministry has said the forces continue to inflict heavy losses on the Ukrainian troops that have crossed the border into Kursk earlier this week. Defence ministry in Moscow reported on Friday, providing an estimate of Kiev's casualties. According to the ministry, Ukraine has lost about 945 soldiers as well as 102 armoured vehicles, including 12 tanks and 17 armoured personnel carriers. The figures include more than 280 troops and 27 armoured vehicles destroyed just in the past 24 hours. The report also stated Russian airstrikes have been destroyed 5 Stryker armoured personnel carriers, as well as Ukrainian military column that consisted of a tank, 4 APCs and a Kozak combat vehicle. The ministry added that the operation to repel and destroy Ukraine's forces in the region continues. The Russian military, aided by airstrikes and artillery fire, has prevented the attempts to conduct raids deeper into Russian territory. The whole flavour of this article on RT, Martin, is that they're taking an unrushed approach to this.
Well, there's no point panicking when you're in a long war. They've done this before. They seized Snake Island so many times now, but they never be able to hold it. They crossed the Dnipro, I think, river, and they had people on the other bank, but there was nothing they could do. They were just a sitting target. The purpose of all this is PR victories for the Western Daily Mail reading classes. Oh, yes, they are winning. They're not losing. They're going to win in the end. But it's increasingly threadbare, because the Russians, basically, they're digging in for the long haul. They're not even fighting the Ukraine. They're fighting the West. They know that this fight is going to go on now for some years to come, and they're making their plans accordingly. But I think the real hit for this is going to be in the Middle East. And also, of course, what's happened in Mali this week, I don't know if you've seen this, the Ukrainians are claiming that they helped rebels in Mali to kill Malian soldiers and their Russian allies from Wagner. And Mali has broken off diplomatic relations with the Ukraine and said, you know, you are enemies of Mali. So this war is now spreading, as wars do, like the First World War. People in Africa ended up fighting in it, even though it started in the Balkans. That's what World Wars
do. Also, staying with Ukraine, Russia's got its first F-16 fighter jets this week, finally, from NATO members, according to Bloomberg. The number of jets is small, says TASS, the Russian news agency. The first batch of F-16 fighter jets supplied by NATO has arrived in Ukraine. According to the news agency, the number of jets is small. It's not clear whether Ukrainian pilots who've trained in the West will immediately use the warplanes or the process will take longer. Bloomberg does not elaborate on the exact number of jets on the names of the countries that have supplied them. I said the transfer of X-16s was a long-awaited move, more than a year to complete. Volodymyr Zelensky has complained that F-16s promised had still not arrived in July. US President Joe Biden said, "We're working with our NATO allies to ensure Ukraine is flying F-16s this summer." Russian President Vladimir Putin emphasised deliveries of weapons and equipment, including F-16s, would not reverse the situation, would result in the protraction of the conflict. He also pointed out if supplied to Ukraine, F-16 jets will burn, exactly like other military equipment, which is hyped by the West, does. So that's Putin's reaction. Now, why is it that the F-16s are so sensitive, Martin?
Well, it's more propaganda than anything else. It doesn't make any major difference to the fighting on
the
ground.
Russians have said it may do, because these jets can carry standoff cruise missiles, which could have nuclear warheads on. So the Russians aren't very happy.
What they've been saying is, if one of these jets fires at us, we might have to presume that that's a nuclear missile.
Well maybe it's so if one of these jets even takes off rather than even fires, because they can't allow it to take off. Surely
they put these short-range missiles into Germany now, which is absolutely provocative. And they just don't know when to stop, do they? And I think the Russians, it's taken a while for the Russian population to come to terms with what they're up against, but they're now pretty solidly behind their government, even though they've taken horrible casualties. I mean, the people in Russia, value human life just as people everywhere do. Nobody wants war, really, sensible people. But they're also not prepared to back down, and they're ready to take this on, because they're not going to be prepared to have short-range missiles literally 2 minutes away from Moscow. If the Russians did that and put some missiles into Cuba, you know what would happen. So there's no way, Jose, that they're going to accept that. They will fight and fight and fight to stop that. And one of the ways to fight, of course, is before they even get there, is to blow up the airfields. The airfields they're going to use, they have to use, they're pretty fussy kind of planes. They can't take off on motorways, for example. They need a proper airfield. The Ukrainians haven't got any proper airfields left, so they'll have to fly from Poland or Romania. Now, if that's the case, then Poland and Romania have joined the war.
Well, what they're saying is that these jets are now in Ukraine. They're not saying they're in Poland or Romania. They're saying they're in Ukraine.
Well, if they're in Ukraine, that could just be propaganda, because where are they going to put them? You can't take off unless you've got an airfield to take off from. Their airfields have all been smashed up completely long time ago. It's just, it's more hopium by the people in the West who want this war to carry on. They're now even talking about, you can see they're in total panic. There's some people saying, well, we're going to have to negotiate. And this Kursk manoeuvre, I think, is part of that, because if they can hang on to this slice of Russia proper, they can bargain it away for a bit of something else somewhere else. But I don't think the Russians are in a mood to bargain about anything now. They are going to take all four oblasts which voted to leave the Ukraine. And, of course, the two that voted, Donetsk and Luhansk, voted to leave the Ukraine in 2014. And that's the basis of the mandates that the Russians have to defend the Russian speakers in their area.
It seems it's already started, the Ukraine thing. Is the idea is it's just going to get, whatever we do, it's just going to make things worse and worse and worse and worse. And there is going to be no peace agreement there. What do you think?
Well, I think that's right. What will happen is that the Ukrainian army will ultimately disintegrate, probably before the end of this year. There might be a coup in Ukraine itself. There's obviously going to be mass chaos. And as the winter comes in, lots of people are going to try and leave the Ukraine because they can't survive with all the electricity off. And they're all going to end up in Poland and Germany, where people are already on their uppers because of the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And of course, we've had all this fuss in this country about immigration. We saw that happening in Dublin not that long ago. But the vast majority of people in Dublin who are asylum seekers are from Ukraine, more than half. So if there's any problem with access to social services or any of the other issues that people talk about, immigration, it's because you sided with the Ukrainians. And of course, the Ukrainians who fled to the West were not in any real danger anyway. They've all fled from the West Ukraine, where there was hardly any fighting. All the killing has been in the East Ukraine. In fact, millions of people have fled the East Ukraine into Russia from 2014 onwards. So the ones who came over here are ones, Ukraine is actually a basket case. And many of them would love to emigrate to the West. And the West just say, oh, you can come. So they've all come. And they're not going home. We'll have to integrate them.
I mean, I think what you're pointing out here is that the mass media has played a massive part in just keeping this war going and keeping the various illusions that Ukraine has got to win, making out that the Ukrainians are somehow the victims, where actually they spent many years just lobbing bombs into the Donbass region purely because the people in there spoke Russian and they didn't like them, and they decided that they were going to secede from Kiev, which was a complete completely normal thing to do. Anyway, look, one of the big bits of news of the week is Scott Ritter's raid by the FBI. But like I said at the start, I don't really want to talk too much about what happened there. He's put out a few videos and statements and things about it. Obviously, massive sympathy with Scott because the whole accusation originally, which kept him off the mass media, was to do with some kind of he was accused of paedophilia, but in a chat room where everybody had to prove their credentials of being over 18, and that this person that he is supposed to have had paedophilic relations with wasn't even a woman. It was a bloke pretending to be a girl. But
that's
anyway,
not why the FBI have raided him.
No, that's not why the FBI. It's why he's been kept off the press. The excuse that's been used by the mass media never to interview him. Anyway, we're going to hear now from the interview with Judge Neapolitano, Judging Freedom, which was recorded just the day before he got assassinated. So here he's picking up on the Hani. Not sorry, before he got raided. Yeah, before he got raided. It's the assassination of Hania, which I was actually trying to refer to, who was the Hamas leader. And we've heard, Martin, haven't we, just like last couple of days, the Israelis are saying whoever replaces him, we're going to assassinate him too. This isn't a very good attitude if they want any kind of negotiated settlement or if they want the hostages back, surely.
Well, no, and therefore everybody's preparing for the big war.
Let's get to think about what
our plan's going to be.
Let's have a listen to Scott's Scott's assessment of the whole situation there in the Middle East, which may have been what he's saying here may have been partly have led. In fact, somewhere I'll put the full interview up as well tonight, but it's absolutely fascinating to hear him take apart what's going on down there now.
There's some question as to whether or not Netanyahu gave the United States a heads up that he was going to do this. And I think that the answer is he did give the United States heads up. I know the United States denies this, but something of this scope and scale couldn't have been carried out without the United States at least knowing that it was happening so that we could, you know, be prepared to respond. Israel attacked Iran. It's straight up. And Iran has said that that is a red line and that Iran's retaliation will be on a scope and scale greater than that which took place back in April when they carried out Operation True Promise. And this appears to be the direction that Iran is heading. Some people predict that this attack will take place tonight. We don't know. I mean, Iran gets to make that decision, the timing and the level of retaliation is purely an Iranian decision. But Netanyahu had to know that by attacking Iran the way he did, that he was going to push Iran to where they needed to retaliate, and this would take it to another level. Whether he believes that the United States would intervene or he was trying to force the Americans to intervene, I don't know. The United States has indicated that it will not participate in offensive actions against the Iranians, that all they'll do is defend Israel from any Iranian missile attack. You know, what happens when Hezbollah joins in the fight? What happens if Iraq, you know, the pro-Iranian militias in Iraq do? There's already indication that American bases have been attacked in Iraq, maybe as a precursor to a larger regional offensive by the Axis of Resistance. We're in a very, very dangerous situation right now, and it's all because of Benjamin Netanyahu's desire to hold on to political power at any cost.
What do you think will happen in the next several weeks because of the evil that Netanyahu has wrought?
If Iran retaliates on the level that it has indicated would be retaliation for such an attack, we could be looking at tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of lives lost, a general war between Iran and Israel that could drag the region in and drag the United States and maybe even Russia and China into it. You know, Israel has indicated that if Iran strikes civilian targets, that it will hit Iran's nuclear infrastructure. And Iran, of course, would respond by hitting Israel's nuclear infrastructure, and the escalation would go from there. You know, so we're looking at, you know, the real possibility that densely populated urban areas, both in Israel, Iran, and elsewhere, Beirut, could be hit with very lethal conventional weapons. Again, on a scope and scale that we haven't seen. I mean, you know, Ukraine doesn't the war in Ukraine definitely isn't done in this fashion. If you go to Kiev, the capital, people are partying, they're walking, they're shopping. You hardly know that there's a war. That won't be the case if there's a general conflict between Israel and Iran. Tehran, Isfahan, these cities will be hit. Tel Aviv, Haifa, these cities will be hit. And, civilian targets will be hit. Civilians will pay a very heavy price.
Here's Hassan Nasrallah 2 days ago. Tell me what you think. Cut number three.
The enemy and those behind the enemy must wait for our inevitable reaction, God willing. There is no discussion or controversy about this.
Does he mean what he says?
I believe he does, but again, he was very, non-descriptive in what he said, meaning that, it's open to interpretation. Would he participate in a general retaliation with Iran, or would he hold off and strike at a time and place of his choosing? We have yet to see. Nasrallah has been a master of escalation management and not one to, jump off the deep end precipitously. But I do think that he will take guidance from Iran's actions. Now, we know that the former defense minister of Russia, Sergei Shoigu, has flown to Tehran. There seems to be a stream of Russian military aircraft flying to Iran, presumably delivering high-tech military equipment, maybe air defense systems, maybe surface-to-surface missile systems. We don't know. Could the Russians be asking the Iranians to delay, to tone things down, or are the Russians saying, we're here with you? We do know that Sergei Lavrov said about Israel's actions that Israel can't expect Russia to sit on the sidelines forever.
Is that unusual that Lavrov would say that and that Shoigu would personally go to Tehran? Does that indicate to you a level of interest in the outcome of this dispute on the part of the Kremlin?
Absolutely. First of all, we know that Russia and Iran have signed a defense agreement. The details of which haven't been made public, but Russia and Iran are operating on a different level altogether today than they were this time last year, this time 6 months ago, this time 3 months ago. They are strategically connected. Russia and Iran have signed a deal that connects St. Petersburg with the southern Iranian ports of Chabahar and Bandar Abbas, providing connectivity that can't be blocked by the United States. They're linked in terms of industrial cooperation, geopolitical cooperation, and Russia has indicated that it is a strategic ally of Iran. So I think, Israel and the United States have to proceed with caution, because this could very well turn into a conflict that, has Russia jumping in on the side of Iran, and that potentially puts Russia not only at odds with Israel, and there's Sergei Lavrov's statement, we're not going to sit on the sidelines forever. Right. I think Russia has already made decisions. They're off the sidelines. They're off the bench. They're on the field. Now the question is, what game does Israel want to play?
Does Iran have nuclear weapons, Scott?
I believe they do not. I believe they have the ability to enrich uranium of sufficient enrichment that could be used in a nuclear device. Is it going to be a uranium weapon, a plutonium weapon? If it's a uranium weapon, then they've got to convert it into metal. They could make a simple gun design that's not that complex, but, an implosion device requires work on high explosives that, the Iranians haven't, to my best of my knowledge, completed yet. It's also something that the Iranians said that they weren't going to do. I'm more worried, to be honest, about a Pakistani weapon than I am about an Iranian weapon.
What is your worry about a Pakistani weapon, that the Pakistanis would deliver a nuclear weapon at a target that Iran picked?
I think if Israel uses nuclear weapons, which is something that if there's a general war between Israel and Iran, it's very likely that Israel would use some sort of nuclear device. It would be necessary to, for instance, penetrate into the Firdos nuclear facility, which is underground. It can't be penetrated by any conventional weapons. Israel would have to use a nuclear penetrator to get to it. If Israel used a nuclear weapon against Iran, it's inevitable that an Islamic weapon will hit Israel. It's inevitable. I'm just trying to be as clear as I can be about this. It's inevitable that an Islamic weapon will hit Israel and probably destroy Israel. And the Pakistanis have made it clear that that weapon probably will have Made in Pakistan on it. Whether the Pakistanis deliver it themselves or give it to Iran to deliver, that's a question for the future to decide. But Israel needs to know that there is no free pass. They don't get to use a nuclear weapon and nothing happens. Eventually, if Israel uses a nuclear weapon, Israel will be destroyed by nuclear weapons.
Interesting, isn't it? I'd not come across that before, Martin. It might be this is one of the reasons Imran Khan has been shunted out of the way by the Yanks in Pakistan.
Well, yes, certainly so. But the Pakistani military, who are now really in charge, they're not necessarily terribly friendly to the Israelis either. And of course, they are, to some extent, under the control of the Americans. Obviously, I'm not going to argue with Scott Ritter. He's a nuclear weapons inspector and a former U.S. Marines colonel. He's an expert. I'm just a commentator. But it's a very dangerous situation we've ended up in here. Absolutely ridiculous. I mean, the obvious solution to all of this would have been for the Americans and their British allies to read the Riot Act to the Israelis years ago.
Not happening, is it? Because it's a little cult. There's a kind of clique of these warmongers, Martin, and they are absolutely hell-bent on starting these wars. And there's a certain inevitability. It's like a ratchet system. It's going click, click, click. The ratchet is just tightening all the time. It's inevitable, surely.
Well, this August is as dangerous as August 1914 or 1939. That's what it is. The guns of August, and we already had a fairly tense situation because of what's been happening in the Ukraine, but of course the Israelis are the wild card.
I'll put the link to that long interview the day after it. Scott Ritter was arrested, had his home searched by the FBI, so well worth listening to the whole thing. There's all sorts in there.
Well, I understand today, Tony's further developments, a SWAT team came round to his house, local police SWAT team, saying that there's some, one of his family had been involved in, something else, because when they came round, they're questioning him about the money he took from Russia Today, because of course he's been a regular on Russia Today, like I used to be, and he got paid for it, like people do. I mean, not everybody can do journalism for free and people have to make a living, but they're saying that means he's an agent of a foreign power, which is why they've taken his passports off him and wouldn't let him go to Russia. And now they're trying to prosecute him for taking money off RT, which is owned by the Russian government, but it's not the Russian government. And, I think in US law, people are allowed to do journalistic work for foreign news outlets.
Well, this is where it's going with us, Martin. I mean, over the years, RT were paying us. The sanctions regime since the invasion of Ukraine by the Russians has meant that it's now a crime for RT to pay us. I mean, you or I can go on to one of these foreign things, but we're not allowed to be paid. So the idea is you can do free journalism, but you're not allowed to be paid anymore. That seems to be the way they're running it.
When Scott Ritter's gone over to these various conferences to meet with the Russian military and so on, because he's hugely respected over there, well, they pay for his hotel bills and so on. Not everybody's Elon Musk. People have to make
so this is an important part, and of course Bill Browder has been involved in this Magnitsky Act, which is one of the precursors of making sure that there is no trade allowed between no money is allowed to pass between Russia and Europe and the Anglo-Zionist Empire. And of course, the Turks have made an absolute fortune out of this because they're running stuff both ways and making a cut on it as they do so. But it's a very interesting section of that where Scott Ritter talks about Evan Dershowitz, who's the journalist who's been released by the Russians, and details exactly why the Russians know he was a spy. He wasn't just a journalist, and all the details of that. Very interesting. But we'll have a little clip, another final one from Scott, about the Israeli far right being involved in the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin back in 1995, who was just about to sign a massive peace agreement with Yasser Arafat and the PLO and the Palestinians.
The issue of Israel's far right religious population, and the Talmudic scholars and students, you know, it's been haunting Israel for some time. Yitzhak Rabin's assassin, the man who pulled the trigger on Yitzhak Rabin back in November of 1995, I believe, he claims that he was ordered to do this by a Talmudic Jewish rabbi who said that Yitzhak Rabin had violated Israeli law, was now an enemy of the Israeli people, and therefore had to be killed, that it was his religious duty to do this. This is the kind of perverted thinking that's widespread in Israel, that many of the battalions that operate in Gaza are reserve battalions drawn from Talmudic universities or camps. And these students believe that they have every right to murder, to rape, to pillage, to do whatever they want against non-Jews, and there's no crime. And they celebrate these crimes. So, you know, Alistair Cook's on to something.
He certainly is. Martin, this is a pretty horrific part of, the dark heart of Judaism here, that there are some groups that just think that they can do what they want to anybody that's not Jewish, that they're basically treated as animals.
Well, that's right. I mean, we've got all of these geopolitical struggles, control of oil, control of natural resources. And then on top of that, we've got people who really do want the end of the world, because they believe in another world different from this one, and that they've got the right to take life as part of this great plan of which they seem to be feel that they are a part. And that's very dangerous, isn't it? Because it's not even rational. You can't really argue with these people or deter them, can you?
Yeah, you can't. And just to go back to what we were discussing in the first part, also the Iranians making the point this week that they're sticking up for the monotheistic faiths, Jesus specifically, even though they're Muslims, far more than someone like Tommy Robinson. They don't like, just like many Christians in the West don't like, the parody of Da Vinci using this drag queen festival thing at the beginning of the Paris Olympics.
Respect for Jesus is definite matter for Muslims. Iran's supreme leader on Olympics row. Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei criticized a drag queen parody of The Last Supper at the Paris Olympics. He stated that respect for Jesus Christ is essential for Muslims and condemned the act, calling it an insult to the holy figures of divine religions, including Jesus Christ.
I dug out a clip, an interview actually, a BBC interview from The World at One from February 2008. Christopher Landau interviewed the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. I don't know if you remember that, Martin, but he was very controversial at the time, saying that actually Islamic Sharia law was already, to a certain extent, integrated into British law. So all these people, the Tommy Robinson Brigade, saying, oh, they're trying to take over. And he makes the point also that the synagogues also have their own law for rulings within their own community. So there's a lot of similarities between old school Christian church law, which mostly went out of the window with the Reformation, as well as Sharia law and Jewish law, and that's all perfectly normal. So why did Rowan Williams bring that up back in 2008?
Well, I think he was trying to be helpful by explicating to the general population what really goes on. I mean, as you are aware, Jewish law is, it's Jewish rabbis in Orthodox synagogues who can decide questions about divorce, for example, and who's allowed to be divorced, and that they are allowed to do that under British law. And, of course, it's possible that Muslims could do the same, although I don't think, by and large, they do that. I think that, this is a bit of a red herring, really. Most people in Britain, everybody in Britain really is subject to British law, and that includes Jewish
synagogues. Hang on. Yes, I know, but what they're saying is, look, Martin, you're sort of ignoring what I'm saying, really, which is a bit irritating, but the idea is that the Jewish communities, Islamic communities and Christian communities, to a certain extent, they have perfectly legal bodies which oversee these institutions which do use these sorts of law. And if somebody is unhappy about the way that's done, done, then they can appeal to the wider legal system, the jurisdiction outside. But what he's saying is this whole thing about trying to demonize Sharia law is a joke.
Well, I think it's what it is it's a way of trying to stir things up.
Exactly.
There isn't Sharia law in most of the Arab world. If you've got secular government, for example, in Egypt, no Sharia law. Within what's left of Gaza, no Sharia law. It's just it's the sort of thing that gets the Tommy Robinsons of the world going.
Quite right. Anyway, I thought it was very, very good of Rowan Williams at the time to bring this up and to make the point that actually much of what Muslims believe is far, far closer to old Christian church law than a lot of our modern secular laws. But anyway, let's have a little listen to that clip of that thing I dug out, and I'll put a link up to the full one on the show page at thisweek.org.uk.
It seems unavoidable, and indeed, as a matter of fact, certain provisions of Sharia are already recognised in our society and under our law. So it's not as if we're bringing in an alien and rival system. We already have in this country a number of situations in which the law, the internal law of religious communities, is recognised by the law of the land as justifying conscientious objections in certain circumstances. So I think we need to look at this with a clear eye and not imagine either that we know exactly what we mean by Sharia and just associate it with what we read about Saudi Arabia or whatever.
But I suppose Sharia does have this very clear image in people's minds, whether it's stoning or what might happen to a woman who's been raped. These are big hurdles to overcome if you're trying to rehabilitate Sharia.
There's a lot of internal debate within the Islamic community about the nature of Sharia and its extent. Nobody in their right mind, I think, would want to see in this country the kind of inhumanity that's sometimes been associated with the practice of the law in some Islamic states, the extreme punishments, the attitudes to women as well. And I think one of the points, again, that's come up very interestingly in recent discussion between Muslim and other legal theorists is the way in which, in the original context of Islamic law, quite often provisions relating to women are more enlightened than others of their day. But you have to translate that into a setting where actually that whole area of the rights and liberties of women has moved on. And the principle and the vision which animates the Islamic legal provision needs broadening because of that.
One of the examples you give where Sharia might be applied is in relation to marriage. What would that look like? What would that mean for example, a British Muslim woman suddenly given the choice to settle a dispute via a Sharia route as opposed to the existing British legal system?
It's very important that you've mentioned the word choice. I think it would be quite wrong to say that we could ever license, so to speak, a system of law for some community which gave people no right of appeal, no way of exercising the rights that are guaranteed to them as citizens in general. So that a woman in such circumstances would have to know that she was not signing away anything for good and all. I think I'm simply saying that there are ways of looking at marital dispute, for example, which provide an alternative to the divorce courts as we understand them. In some cultural and religious settings, they would seem more appropriate.
Is part of the challenge that Sharia is regarded as it is? For example, the European Court of Human Rights says quite simply its view is that Sharia is incompatible with democracy and therefore it would be very difficult to see it incorporated in any meaningful way.
That's a pretty sweeping judgment, I think. And again, it seems to me to suggest that the court is regarding Sharia as a single fixed entity. And a great many Muslim jurists would now say that that is not how you need to see it. There are other ways of coming at it. I think there is a real question about how the discourse of human rights relates to traditional idioms of Islamic law. A real discussion, and there's a lot of literature about that. But I don't think we should instantly spring to the conclusion that the whole of that world of jurisprudence and practice is somehow monstrously incompatible with human rights simply because it doesn't immediately fit with how we understand it. And as I said earlier, it's not something that's absolutely peculiar to Islam. We have Orthodox Jewish courts operating in this country, not to mention the issues, as I mentioned earlier, not to mention the questions about how the consciences of Catholics, Anglicans and others who have difficulty about issues like abortion are accommodated within the law. So the whole idea that there are perfectly proper ways in which the law of the land pays respect to custom and community, that's already there.
So I suppose we should be cheering and shouting to get rid of halakhic law, the Jewish Orthodox courts, Martin, within Jewish institutions. The fact is that the law is actually quite a complicated beastie. We've got international law over the top of British law and the jurisdiction of the United Kingdom. But we've also got these other things in other all sorts of institutions. I suppose trade unions might even be considered to have their own rules. And, you know, if someone isn't happy about the way the trade union's organised itself, they may be able to appeal to an outside court, as they often do, like an employment tribunal, for example, Martin.
Well, that's right. So, in other words, the law is a nested series of boxes, isn't it? I'm not sure how helpful his intervention was, actually.
I think it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. It probably got him sacked by King Charles and the establishment, because he's actually pointing out, look, if we're going to treat Muslims like this, you should also treat other faiths, the Jews and Christians, the same way.
We have, in fact, got Orthodox Jewish courts, but we haven't got Sharia courts, because there's a two-tier policing going on.
Oh, yes, well, maybe. I know, I think it was brilliant, and I think it also, it's one of those reasons why we've got this oil guy, Justin Welby, is now Archbishop of Canterbury. He's completely hopeless, and he's got nothing to say about any of these things. And everything he does say has got absolutely no intellectual rigour to it at all. It's all paper thin, whereas, Rowan Williams, a lot of depth to him, and he was prepared also as Cranmer and other archbishops before him to stand up for what he thought and what he believed in, and he didn't actually get his head chopped off, I don't think. He just got nudged out of the way for saying things like that. So anyway, as we wind up today, Martin, we had a brilliant, amazing, good old Whitney Webb. We heard from her last week, but Neil Oliver has picked up with her. I did a brilliant interview with her. I'll put the full version of that up on our show page later as well, and she goes into quite a lot of detail about the role of the Bilderbergers in the transhumanist alliance with Peter Thiel and people like Eric Schmidt with Neil Oliver. But I thought I'd have a listen to, or what we'd have a listen to, was one of her things that she thinks is the transhumanists and the globalists and the warmongers' Achilles heel. Would you like to just take a stab and guess? It's a bit unfair of me to do this to you, Martin, but what that might be?
Well, the internal contradictions of what they come out with. That's the most,
Well, no, but it doesn't matter, because they just propagandise everything. Anyway, look, well, what she's talking about here, I'll let her say it.
Do you think there's any extent to which it's not the case? You talked about the necessity to find other platforms to look at other ways of doing things, to turn our backs on some of these sort of preeminent figures. Any way in which we're being tricked into thinking that they have more potential control than they do?
I think they absolutely do. And I think that's part of, the manipulations that target the public are to make us think that we're powerless and we have no power. And these people have invested so much money on finding every excuse they can to try and get us, in the case of digital ID, get us to voluntarily want to adopt it. And we have to focus on the fact that if digital ID does not succeed and people do not comply, it will fail. I mean, it is the cornerstone of like the entire UN Agenda 2030. Without it, the programmable surveillable money won't work. A lot of their designs for what they want to do in the online virtual world will not work. And so much of it will not work if we do not comply with digital ID, and they're trying to force it on us as a voluntary thing, sort of in the same way that vaccine passports were voluntary, which is why I encourage people, if you want to change the direction the world is going, you need to figure out how you are going to set up your life so you don't have to comply with digital ID the same way, maybe if you were forced to comply with vaccine mandates and vaccine passports, how will you get around those type of restrictions when they try and impose, digital ID on people for various reasons. As I said earlier, before it was about you know, the vaccine and all of that. Now in the U.S., conservatives mainly are being pitched as this is a solution to illegal migration. This is a solution to voter fraud and all of this stuff. There's efforts to frame biometric digital ID as essential to solving cybercrime and hacking and cyberbullying and any other normal of essentially any ill of society. They're just going to say digital ID is going to be the solution to that. And their sales pitches. But ultimately, if we, you know, the digital ID is essential to the whole idea of the social credit score and any of these other, you know, Orwellian designs that, you know, at least enough people I hope know by now, is part and parcel of this agenda. And I think, again, it comes up to people having to make a choice. And the way they do this is through, you know, they try and get us to comply with this is through convenience. It's convenience to opt in. It's convenient to have a digital ID. It's convenient to have, you know, money on your phone and have your whole life be based on your smartphone and all of this. It's convenient to vote once every 4 years for one of the two lesser evils in all of this. But really, it's the convenience that they're using to enslave us. And it's inconvenient to find ways to opt out of these systems and change your life so that you're more resilient and your life is actually sustainable for you and your family and your community. It's perhaps inconvenient to get out off of the couch and off of the chair and go meet your neighbors physically and stop being on the online world so much. And making real human connections and real human solutions to the problems we're facing. Because, I mean, again, that's why during COVID, the lockdowns, I think, were a big part of it, to keep people isolated, to keep people from connecting and force people to feel like they could only connect with others through this virtual world that these people control. Because they control the infrastructure, the software, and the platforms. So I think, you know, people need to consider that this convenience is really the carrot. Maybe there will be a stick at some point, but they seem to be focused a lot on the carrot and the idea of having us voluntarily adopt these things because it's easy the way they're setting things up, or it will be easy. Or they'll frame it that way at least. But I think it's very important for people to realize that they have the power. Otherwise, they wouldn't be investing all this money to manipulate us and pitch us on this. And, you know, I think it's important for people to think critically about what's being done. And I think, you know, there's a lot of efforts to manipulate prominent voices in alternative media for the purpose of getting people who have realized these agendas during COVID, at least, or maybe before, to come back sort of into the fold and trust certain people that are selling these particular solutions under different metrics. Anyway, again, I think, you know, there is a lot of hope, and a lot of people, you know, listen to my interviews or read my reports and think it's, you know, very black pilling or depressing and whatever. But ultimately, you know, I think it's more depressing to feel like we don't have any power to change things. Only the billionaires do. I think that's a very depressing outlook personally. And I think these are people we should not be trusting, considering the state of the world and where we are going. And we should take the power back as people. And we do that by taking actions in our own lives and doing things in our neighborhoods and our communities and with our families. And realizing that this is not where we want to go at the end of the day. And there is so much we can do. And I think a good starting point, again, is to say no to digital ID. We don't need this biometric digital ID surveillance state that's going to be used not just to surveil what we're doing in real time, but also to predict what we might do in the future. A lot of these you know, plans on the books and things that are being developed by these intelligence agencies are all about predictive policing, meaning pre-crime, and also applying that same methodology to healthcare. Prevent the next pandemic before it happens and all of this stuff. So you don't even need to declare a pandemic anymore to get emergency youth authorization or mandates in particular communities and stuff like that. That is the world they are setting up. It is very bad, and we should opt out. And we can opt out.
We say no. And that's one of the songs we played a few months ago. And of course, this is about disconnecting from Babylon. Anyway, what do you think of her diagnosis there, Martin, about just making sure that you never, ever, ever get involved in this digital ID?
Well, I'm broadly against digital ID for the reasons that she's put forward. But I think they're going to survey you anyway, with or without ID. So don't think by not participating in digital ID you'll have escaped surveillance.
I mean, surely...
You can escape surveillance. It's possible. But I don't want to talk about it online.
Oh, you naughty boy. The other thing about this is from...
Yeah, spies, gangsters and terrorists know how to escape surveillance.
So well, they are. They're running the surveillance. They're running the surveillance software anyway. So, I mean, another thing this it surely links up to, certainly, you know, the way I see it, is to this whole thing of the mark of the beast, the idea that you won't be able to buy or sell without having some sort of microchip, possibly in your hand, in your forehead or whatever, from the Book of Revelation. So maybe we're seeing, you know, Whitney there picking up on some, you know, the idea that you have to have some sort of digital identity to do anything. So anyway, love watching anyway. So I'll put a full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Lovely to see Neil Oliver interviewing her. We've got something from Patrizia Opulenza this week. Rather nice. Thank you, Patrizia. Rumour on the streets, we hear. Tommy's hand, the riots steered. Hand in hand with Israel, a Zionist, we've heard it tell. Whitehall deny the stop on arms to Israel to kill and harm. The people in the Gaza Sea, each day more deaths a tragedy. Hidden hands behind the scenes create disturbances, we've seen. A threat so veiled regarding arms, no guns, no bombs. Your country's harmed. Tommy's brief, in sunny climes, more chaos in the UK chimes. Whispered words from Israel, hidden threats from ne'er-do-wells. Stir up anger on immigration. Confuse abuse, no mitigation. False flags, who knows the tricks they play, collecting fury on the way. No leader talking to the people, the working class they call the sheeple. No discussion on subversion. See inversion, conversion, a tragedy. While Zionists our country shake, do as we want or we will break. Your way of life, the lives you lead, your country wreck, watch as you grieve. An offer made, you can't refuse, mete out demands or you will lose. Thank you, Patrizia. And our final piece this week, I don't know if you want to say something about it before we play it, Martin. It's Roland Dye and the Bristol Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament have just finished a week of an action camp in Castle Park in the city centre for Hiroshima Day. And the camp is rather nice. It starts on the day that Hiroshima was bombed, the anniversary, and it finishes on the day that Nagasaki was bombed. And it's almost as if no one is kind of noticing the fact that we're closer to nuclear war than probably at any time since that point, aren't we?
I think we certainly are. And, of course, it's people don't want to think about it, but that's where we are, yeah.
So on the, I think on the upload, I've got I think it's a great, I haven't got time to play it, but it's a diplomatic dispatch, a conversation with a British ambassador to Russia and the current Russian ambassador to Britain, which is really interesting, I thought. It's nice to know that a lot of diplomats are not going along with the modern Russophobia. So I'll put that up on our show page, a full version of that, and we won't even hear a little bit of it because we haven't got time. But we have got time to hear from Roland Dye and Bristol CND, who've been in the city centre this week at a little camp in Castle Park.
Hi, I'm Roland Dye, and we're here in Castle Park, and this is the fifth year that Bristol, the CND group and Extinction Rebellion have got together to remember over the 4 days the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We start at 8:15 on the 6th, which is the time that the first bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, and we carry on to the 11:02 when the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. So over those 4 days, thanks to a network of local groups and campaign groups and individuals, so we have this program of talks and workshops on all the issues to do with peace, justice, global equality, climate change, and how we need to network and campaign to do something about it.
Now, CND, I can remember going on marches in the 1980s, hundreds of thousands of people, actually, tens of thousands, at least about 80,000, I remember one of them. What about the decision to use the bomb in the first place? This is quite controversial. It even was at the time, wasn't it?
Well, historians are still debating why the bombs were dropped. I mean, the American propaganda machine, of course, leapt on, they were already ready, and they had their news. Press releases written already to say that it shortened the war and it saved lives. Possibly the Soviet Union entering into the war a couple of days later was actually what precipitated Japan to then stop the war. It's complex, it's controversial, but what we do know is it was hideous, it was immoral, it was genocidal. And one of the things we're linking up in over these 4 days is looking at other injustices and other genocidal actions like colonialism, and of course Gaza is very much in our minds just at the moment, and it's the brutality of the people with the power over the people who have less power, and that's what we want to put a stop to, and we want a better world.
Well, a lot of people suggesting that by supplying these long-range missiles to the Ukrainians, also the F-16s, which are capable of launching these standoff nuclear weapons at Russia, that they could make Britain and the NATO countries actually a target for the Russians, and that could obviously spark a wider war. Now, many people who look closely at this are saying we're closer to nuclear war now than we have ever been since World War II, even including the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes, it's absolutely frightening. I mean, we've got what's happening, possibly a regional war in the Middle East. We've got Ukraine and Russia.
Yes, sorry, the Israelis have nukes too, don't they?
They do, although they don't actually admit it. but we know that they do. And, of course, the Far East as well. The Western powers, particularly America, ramping up the pressure on China. It's looking very scary. And, of course, climate change as well is worsening the situation for millions or billions of people around the world. But maybe the events of the last few days here in Bristol and around the country, where the right-wingers have been stirring things up and coming out in force, and Bristol and other cities have risen up, massively outnumbering them, and decided on stand on the side of justice. And that can give us all hope that there's a lot of good people there standing up and being counted.
Don't really see much of CND these days, which is surprising, isn't it? Because if we really are closer to a nuclear war than we've been since World War II, you'd expect CND to be a bit busier.
We had a marvellous chap here talking a couple of days ago, and he went on the first Aldermaston March, and he then joined the Committee of 100, which I only came across them recently. They were the Extinction Rebellion, the direct action group of their time in the late 50s and early 60s. He was arrested 4 times and spent two months in prison. This is almost sounding very familiar with what's been happening to the Just Stop Oil people recently. And it's up to people to find ways of campaigning and applying pressure on the powers that be, that the majority need to be counted and not the minority and not the rich. Back to CND. I mean, it's, you know, CND's had a very long and honourable track record of standing on the right side of history and saying that nuclear weapons are such an abomination. And, you know, I've done workshops here talking about where Britain's nuclear bomb factory is, the fact that it's in special measures from the Health and Safety Executive on safety, how the warheads are transported up to Scotland, exposing the British public to risk if anything catastrophic was to happen. It could actually impair Britain's ability to function as a sovereign state, which is a sharp intake of breath and really scary.
Well, look, a lot of people are putting forward nuclear power as quite a positive influence on the climate, and this is one of the solutions, much better than coal, we're told. But surely the nuclear power industry is actually quite connected to the nuclear weapons industry.
Well, just ask me. I'm a former nuclear scientist. I've got a PhD in it, and for a long time I just followed the establishment line because I didn't know any better, and then by lucky chance I began to, you know, see through it, and I've come over to the other side. So I'm firmly opposed not just nuclear weapons but nuclear power as well, and the reason the government pushed ahead with Hinkley Point C, which is of course turning into a giant white elephant down there in Somerset, is that there is a lot of technical engineering and logistical connections between having nuclear power and maintaining Britain's nuclear deterrent, the submarines up in Scotland. And we don't want either. And also we could save an absolute fortune. I mean, the Trident replacement will cost something like £200 billion over its lifetime. Wouldn't that be better spent on, you know, having funding the NHS properly and social provision and housing and in renewables and fighting climate change? I mean, this is all common sense stuff, and it's up to us to all get together and push for a better, fairer and sustainable world for everybody.
Okay, finally, look, you're someone that sounds like you know a bit about nuclear weapons. We've got the Trident, which is an American weapon. Does Britain really have an independent deterrent, or can the Americans just switch it off if they don't want us to use it?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, Britain likes to claim that it's a British independent nuclear system, but the Americans actually control the tracking and, you know, all that sort of side of it, so it's not independent at all. But while we throw our lot in, we're in the gang, the same as America, then... Everybody keeps smiling, but these things are hideously expensive, they're hideously dangerous, they go wrong, they bump into each other under the ocean, and they're costing us a fortune and bringing us to the brink of nuclear destruction and nuclear winter.
That's a climate issue, is it? Do the climate change people talk about this idea of a nuclear winter? It sounds quite scary that you've got kind of almost like a blanket over the world which is stopping the sun getting in and everything starts to freeze up like the Ice Age.
Yes, I had to go back and read up on that because it was pretty jaw-dropping. I thought it was speculative, but actually it's been well studied that even a limited nuclear exchange, the soot would darken the skies, the sunlight doesn't get in, we'd have crop failure, and we'd have what they call a nuclear winter for several years, and the crops wouldn't grow, and we'd all starve. I mean, that's not much of a defence policy, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. Roland, where can people follow the CND here in Bristol?
Well, get involved. I mean, there's you know, various campaigns we've been running, these workshops here, and Bristol CND, Extinction Rebellion, anti-nuclear power groups. Do your research online. There's a lot of good information out there. Of course, avoid the propaganda and the distractions. And everybody has to gen up and get together. You know, we've been here running this four-day event. Get in touch. We've got a film at the Arc on Broad Street this evening and such like. And Bristol's a good place to get involved in campaigning because... there's so many good people working together for a better world. Thank you.
Okay, Roland Dye, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
So, yeah, good old Roland from Bristol CND, and just about everything else seems around here, Palestine solidarity, etc. He puts a pretty good case there for getting involved in these sorts of activisms. This is all finished now, but what we did have, of course, was the... 79th anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Next year it will be the 80th anniversary. As they say, is remembering the atomic bombs dropped on Japan in 1945, killing more than 250,000 civilians. Peace groups in Bristol were running a four-day peace gathering in Castle Park. And that wasn't just a peace gathering, there's a whole load of workshops they were doing there. So well done, all you fantastic crew. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also, of course, to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. And follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips. Also music, too. Like that rap. Brilliant stuff. And via Not the BCFM Politics Show page. Best place to share it really is on the Telegram channel. Everyone else who's keeping up during the week can see it too there. You'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews. That is, so for example, this week with Tony Greenstein, with Dr. Stephen Dorrell, with Paul English, with Scott Ritter, with Whitney Webb, and with good old Nick Griffin. As well, so that'll all be there later this evening, and there's also the story links, the comment page and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter if you can afford it. You can also donate or even set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. And over Sundays, breakfast at Camberley's Radio Q UK eastone.com. Do please feel free to make live recordings. We've been streaming live from Eastone Studios in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, radiosoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. If you make mistakes, as we all do, please admit them to those involved and to yourself. And let's just say, be upfront. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
There's a woman on my block. She'll just sit there as the night grows still. She'll say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now they take him and they teach him and they groom him for life. Then they set him on a path where he's bound to get ill. They bury him with stars, sell his body like they do used cars. Now there's a woman on my block. She'll just sit there facing the hill. She'll say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused. Great skill. Now all he believes are his eyes, and his eyes they just tell him lies. But there's a woman on my block, sitting there in a cold chill. She say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Maybe noise make a spirit make a heart. Break a bad breaker, leave no stone unturned. Maybe an actor in a plot, that might be all that you got. Tell your error you clearly learn. Now he worships at an altar of a stagnant pool. And when he sees his reflection, he's fulfilled. He wants it all and he wants it his way. Now there's a woman on my block. She just sit there as the night grows still. She say, ooh, wanna take away his license to kill.
The Old Testament lesson is written in the 55th chapter of the book of the prophet Isaiah, in which the sacramental life of the church is prefigured. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and return not thither, but water the earth, making it bring forth and sprout, giving seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, but it shall accomplish that which I purpose, and prosper in the thing for which I sent it. For you shall go out in joy, and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills before you shall break forth into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the cypress, instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle, and it shall be to the Lord for a memorial, for an everlasting sign which shall not be cut off. Here ends the first lesson.
Can't stumble a step foot. Someone else is speaking with my mouth, but I'm listening only to my heart. I've made shoes for everyone, even you, and I still go barefoot. I create said where one's in nature, neither I.